call the required public meeting under Section 3.01 J9 of Article 6243A-1 of the Revised Civil Statutes. So the regular and supplemental meetings are called to order, and we are going to recess both of those and now have our required public meeting on the performance and health of the pension system. And we will have Jeff and Caitlin from Siegel speak first. Any motion of this meeting we'll make during the regular and supplemental meeting, so we're going to take care of it then. So, Jeff, Caitlin, good morning. We've all been studying hard on actuarial, so you'll be shocked at how much we know already. So it'll just be a refresher. Go ahead, it's yours.
Before you start, can I just, we have three new trustees, and I just wanted to explain this weird meeting you haven't seen before. So in the statute that was passed in 2017, they wrote into the statute that two times a year we have to have a required public meeting. And in that meeting, we have to talk about the health and the welfare of the pension system. So during this time of year, when we have the valuation, we have the second one. When we have the first one in the year, you know, the funding values don't change, but we talk about the portfolio performance and the financial statements, those types of things. So that's why this agenda looks a little bit strange. I also wanted to mention that Jeff and Caitlin are with Siegel. We hired Siegel in 2016, and they were very helpful with us when we were going through the crisis with the plan and helping us design the plan changes and working with the PRB. So they've been involved since 2016 forward. So very familiar with our plan. With that, I'll turn it.
Thank you. It's good to be here, and for those I haven't had a chance to meet yet, hope we get to speak soon. Like Kelly mentioned, we've been with Fund since 2016. We are the actuaries. What that means is we determine the liabilities associated with the plan. We get the, just a quick overview, we get the demographic data, all the participant data for everybody who's a member of the plan. We provide the assets. We run the data through our software. We have a certain set of assumptions that the board has approved for valuing liabilities, you know, assumptions based on the investment rate of return, you know, when are people going to retire, terminate, die, become disabled. There's a whole list of assumptions we value. We run that through, we come up with a liability, and then we have the assets provided to us, and then we determine, you know, the funded percentage and the actuarially determined contribution and a lot of other metrics in the plan to kind of look at the plan's health. Do you have the
clicker?
So this is not the actual valuation report. This is just a presentation summary. You should have been provided, I believe, this valuation report. It'll look something like this. I mean, that's a hard copy, but
right.
There's a lot more detail in the report. If there's something we don't discuss here in the summary that you want to talk about that you've seen in the report, just let us know. We can talk about anything in here, but you know, it's about 60 pages of actuarial jargon and numbers, so I didn't really figure everybody wants to go through everything.
So you do have the valuation report. There's two of them, actually. There's one for the regular plan that starts on page 25, and there's one for the supplemental plan, which starts on 96. But if you're ever looking for it, they're on our website, so they'll be posted there if you need it or if you want to look at prior ones.
Is this summary already posted on the website?
It was posted this morning.
Okay.
So this will be a high-level overview. I'm going to skip the portrait, but it's actually very good portraits. So there's a lot on this page. The actual determined contribution, so the actual determined contribution is comprised of what we call a normal cost and an amortization payment on the unfunded liability. Normal cost, simplified, is what's being earned each year. It's a little bit different than that. That's kind of a simple way of looking at it, is the benefits being earned each year. And this is, we include this in the report. This is actually not being contributed on because, you know, the hiring plan, the way this is set up, there's a set contribution being made, but it's important that the determined contribution be disclosed, and we'll talk a little bit later, that's required to be disclosed starting in about a year. But it's being included in the report anyway. So your funding policy has closed amortization periods for the unfunded liability. The initial amortization period for the 2020 unfunded is 25 years. And then future gains and losses each year are amortized over a 20-year basis. So you always have a new layer being added each year. So the effective amortization period based on funding policy is 23 years. But like we'll get to in a minute, that's not really where we're at as far as reality. So the actuarially determined contribution for this year is $228.5 million, which is about 52.3% of pay. This increased from $221.3 million last year. However, actual contributions in 2021 were $165.5 million based on the plan in place. So the difference between what was actuarially determined and the actual contributions were about $54 million. So that difference is going to keep probably getting bigger each year. Each year that the actual determined contribution is not made, it kind of rolls over into the next year. So we expect the ADC to keep getting bigger and bigger, and the difference between the ADC and the actual contributions to keep getting bigger and bigger. What we're expecting down the third bullets down the bottom, what we're expecting in 2022 is roughly $170 million. Against the ADEC of $228.5 million. So that's obviously a big difference. There's nothing we can do about that. That's in the statute. We did include the note, which if the city's actual contributions differ by more than 2% for two consecutive years, the board can recommend changes in the rate. But you can recommend, you can't certainly force changes in the rate. But based on the expected city contributions and, of course, the employee contribution, the unfunded liability has a projected amortization period of currently 68 years, up from 63 years last year. And that is not considered, I don't think it needs to be said, but we've included it anyways, that is not considered a reasonable amortization period by any actuarial standard, the Texas Pension Review Board, pretty much anybody. But that's where you're, if everything... We do our projections. If everything happens exactly as expected, which we know is the case, but if everything happens as expected by the assumptions and the assets, then liability will be fully funded in 68 years.
I will add we are building in a 13% market value loss for 2022.
Right.
You've already built that in?
Yes. That's already included.
A big – okay. I thought this was as of the beginning of the year only.
It is, but when we're – looking at the projections, we did build that in based on Brendan and Kelly's.
Right. Okay, thank you.
So it's, I mean, and really, based on the markets in 2022, I don't know what it's going to be next year, but it's going to be longer than 68, I can tell you that. It's just realistic. I hate to be gloom and doom, but it is what it is. I mean, the numbers are going to be what they are. We are building in a 13%, so maybe it won't be. I may overstep there. We are accounting for a 13% loss already, but that's also the contributions depending on where they come in compared to the ADEC. I wouldn't be surprised if it's in the 70s, put it that way. Hopefully not. But that's just kind of informational, is what it is right now. So the funded ratio on an actuarial basis, and just as a reminder, we smooth in market gains and losses on a five-year period, but the actuarial value, the valuation is a snapshot one day in time, so we don't go just by the market value because there's going to be fluctuations in the market prior to the end of the plan year. We're looking at this as a long-term proposition, so those gains and losses smooth out over a five-year period. On an actuarial basis, your percentage declines 41.06%. On a market basis, it actually increased. There was a good market year in 2021, from 37.99 to 41.83. Now, one thing I don't know if we included it in the summary. It is included in the valuation summary and the highlight. We said from the very beginning the fund percentage is going to get worse before it gets better, even after the 2017 plan changes. We still hold with that. I mean, long term, it's going to keep going. It's going to go down. There's a little bump in the market value this year. The long term, we expect it to go down before it comes back up. So there's a lot of plan changes that have been made. We're helpful. Employees are certainly contributing a hefty, 13.5% right now, members are. Yes.
And Jeff, I would just confirm this. It really has most to do with the proportionality of retirees versus actives. That is dynamic. As those people retired, work their way through the system, and the number of people paying into it. So the city hitting its hiring plan is very, very important.
But
we kind of use the thought of like that when you see the World War II movies where the plane takes off the carrier and it dips, you're not really sure whether it, and then you see it kind of go up. So we're going to have that just as a matter of numbers. Market returns matter, but it's really more the ratio of people receiving benefits versus paying into it.
That is a big portion.
Yeah.
Fire and police is not a growth industry. Your numbers are only going to get so high. But retiree count is going to keep increasing. There'll be natural attrition, of course, but I don't recall exactly where what's the percentage now that NASA does it.
Like a 107.
It's about even. That'll keep as pension plans mature. That happens with pretty much every plan. As they mature, you're going to have more folks getting paid a benefit or do a benefit in the future than are actively contributing to the fund. That's how pension plans kind of work long term. So the actuarial value of assets dropped a little bit, 2.13 to 2.12 billion. Market value did increase over 2 billion to 2.16. Cash outflow was relatively stable, a little bit more negative, but not too bad. Your target is 6.5%. Market return 16.99, and actual return was 4.68%. This was, I think, the first year you've had a market, gain in a while. Maybe you're still unwinding, some of the.
Why was that word so hard to come out of your mouth?
Well, you guys were.
Say it one more time.
You guys, yeah. Y'all weren't able to fully capture the good markets the last few years prior to 22, like some of your contemporary funds, just because some of the investments you were trying to get out of.
You say you built in a 13% decline for 22 in the actuarially determined contribution. That's not in the funded status, though, is it?
No, not as of.
Not as of that day, right? Okay.
But it's in the years to fund number.
Right.
Yeah, in the years to fund.
Right. It's reflected in that 68 years.
Okay.
So, Jeff, we haven't reached, to visually picture this, we haven't reached the bottom of our J curve yet.
No, and we have a.
There's a chart in there somewhere.
Yeah, Kelly,
there's a chart that will show you exactly where it is somewhere later.
Yeah. We do project it coming out. It's going to be interesting to see the actual. Hopefully, the actual performance is worse than what we're estimating. We'll find out. There were a couple assumption changes made. The administrative expense assumption was lowered from $8.5 to $7 million. The COLA assumption, which really we kind of meant to do it last year, but the way the COLA is set up is 5 percentage points less than the return assumption. So if the return assumption is lowered, I think that should lower automatically. So we lowered that from 2% to 1.5%. That's obviously an assumption, not indicative of what will or won't happen. And then the COLA start years is based on projected to be 70% funded. That extended from 2069 to 2073. So, happy good news right there. The reconciliation of the actual determined contribution from year to year. I won't read through every line item. You can see it there. But prior to the assumption changes, we went from $221.3 million to $230.9. The assumption changes lowered it by $2.4 million. So there was different gains and losses based on either demographic experience or investment losses. There was a pretty good bump in the expected payroll increase. Now, there's different components. You can break it down really into the minutiae if you want to go deep enough to every assumption, but that's not something we typically delve into that far. I'm going to turn this over to you if you want to take control.
Yeah, I'm not going to read off every number on here, but I do want to point out a few things. you know, normal costs, that's when we're talking about the cost of benefit accruals each year for your current active population. I'm going to focus on the numbers as a percentage of computation pay. Total normal costs, that's what's the total cost of, you know, benefits each year for your active members? Coming in around 17.1% of pay. You remember, membership is contributing 13.5%. So when we talk about, you know, what maybe needs to happen to get this plan back on track, you know, the annual cost of benefits for active is mainly being covered by what they're putting in. There's not really much of a lever you can pull there to get more, to help this fund get back on track. We're really talking about the issue being the big bucket of unfunded liability that's been sitting out there. It's retirees and or actives who have worked, you know, 20-some years. There's not a lot. You're limited in your options, what you can do as far as lowering your normal costs further, and really what impact that would have on your projected funded status.
Caitlin, just on the normal cost, so that's 17%. That's a combined normal cost. But a new employee, I thought I read in your report,
that's true. It's closer to like 15.5. You're right. That includes, that's for the entire active population, including some that are, you know, on the older plan of rent. Partially on the older plan of benefits. Obviously, new members today have a lower. Yep, that's right.
Right. When all the, not legacy members, but all the members who are getting previous benefits, once they're all gone, you know, barring any other plan changes, that normal cost percentage will be closer to 15%.
So that's when the next line there, employer normal cost. That's looking at the cost, benefit accruals, administrative expenses after the 13.5 that membership is shipping in. So that's, you know, we have down there that your ADEC is 52% of pay. And really only 5% of that is going towards, you know, annual cost of benefits. So 45% of computation pay in that calculation is what's hypothetically going to your unfunded. I think the actual statutory contributions for 2022, I guess, it's roughly 40% of computation pay. So same thing, you've got about 5% of that going towards actual costs versus 35% of computation pay and what you're contributing going to paying off the unfunded.
Just real quick, I work on other fire and police plans as well, and 17.1% is not a bad normal cost. I mean, that's not like this is, it's like we said, closer to 15% for newer hires. If, you know, magically the unfunded liability disappeared, you know, the city's kicking in just over 5% a year, and they're dancing in the streets. You know, they're thrilled. This is the city, the employees are putting in a pretty good chunk of change themselves, and this is not out of line, the 17% for fire and police funds. It really isn't. It's just the unfunded, like Caitlin mentioned, the unfunded liability that's blowing up. And there's, I mean, different things contributed to that.
Can you back up a slide?
Yeah.
Something just flashed. But the unfunded liability for 2022 is
about $3 billion.
Okay.
And that's, I don't think we say it as explicit in the HERS and the valuation report, but that number is going to go up even as assets go up, at least for
a while.
Just based on the nature of, you know, contributions coming in. Like I said, you're paying off some of the unfunded, but it's not quite enough to really make a dent for a while.
Okay. I mean, the benefit payments are roughly, what, $275 million a year, $280 million a year, somewhere in there. I have to double check. Contributions coming in, you know, $165, $170 million. The administrative expenses. So you're net negative before the year starts. And that's not unusual for a fund. We mentioned that a couple pages prior, but we say the cash outflow, 107 million. So you're 107 million kind of in the hole before investments. But that's not unusual for a mature fund. Usually contributions don't quite measure up to debt payments.
It just jumps out of some of the changes in the plan population from last year to this year. Obviously, a slight decrease in active members, but we did see, despite the small decrease in active members, an increase in the total pay, not just on an average basis, but the total computation pay that's in there. We'll talk more about the hiring plan payroll a little later on, but at least for this year, the city is still on track with that plan, whereas maybe in some of the early years they were not on track. They have gotten much more in line with what their hiring plan is. And that's after, you know, 2020 and some things. Good to see. You know, retirees and beneficiaries still going up. You know, that's going to continue to happen as you have participants retire. And also number and drop, active members in the drop, obviously is going to continue to go down. I think most of the people we're seeing enter the drop today are participants who have hit that 90% benefit max. That's in the plan, and outside of that, we don't see a whole lot of people going to drop just because of the much different benefit than it was 5-10 years ago.
So just for perspective, in 2015 or 2016, there was 1,400 people in drop, and they either retired or they did a drop revocation, so that number's dropping. The drop number's dropping.
This is just looking at the asset returns over, you know, what, the past 14 years. I'm not going to touch on every number here. One thing I will point out, Jeff talked about smoothing assets. That darker blue, that's your actuarial rate of return. You know, the teal kind of lighter blue color is your market rate of return. You can see part of the reason we're smoothing is to give a much more level basis there. We know the market has its peaks and valleys, but when we're looking long term, we want to try and smooth those out. I'll also point out, because it kind of feeds into the next page, we have the average returns there at the bottom, you know, most recent five-year return on a market value basis under 6%, and 10-year return under 3.5%. We all know the market's been good the past decade until this year. Yes, there's volatility in recent years, but unfortunately, because of the investments that this plan had to unwind out of, it really did kind of miss a good investment period. You know, we're talking a five-year return under 6%. I think that's pretty, a little out of whack with what we see on other plans, and it is due to the nature of the investments here. Like I said, that kind of leads into this next chart. This is looking at the actuarial accrued liability compared to the market and actuarial value. Something we added this year, though, is that dotted teal line, that's the hypothetical market value. If you took the assets as of January 1, 2013, assumed the same cash flows that actually happened, but assumed instead that your investment returns each year were equal to what they were assumed to be on an actuarial basis. So that would have been 8.5% through 2014, 7.25% for a few years after that, 7% in 2020, 6.5% last year. Basically, what are long-term assumptions worth the plan? You'd have closer to $4 billion today. That's not to kind of belabor the point, but, you know.
There's just kind of showing how we got where we are.
You know,
you know that, but it's important to.
And you see too, you see the drop in the accrued liability from 2016 to 2017. You know, the liabilities come up since that point, but it's definitely slowed the growth of where that was going. And you know, like I said, I don't want to belabor the point, but investments are a big part of this, at the story here, and having to unwind some stuff and take breakdowns and. Also, the run on the bank, if you will, kind of how we've gotten to where we are today, and it's not headed in the wrong.
It says that we would have been closer to 80% funded instead of 40%.
Correct.
And we had market returns.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, and that's just that's assuming the same number of benefit payments were paid, contributions came in. Just assuming you got more of that assumed rate of return on assets. I'm not going to touch on this. This is just looking at the funded percentage. You know, you have been kind of holding steady the past few years, but it has been going down slightly. We've got a graph later on that looks going forward, but again, you know, it's kind of getting worse a little bit before it gets to the point where it tips back up and gets better.
The 14 to 15, it was kind of mentioned on the prior page. That's where up through 14, the discount rate, return assumption was 8.5%. That predates us. It was 8.5%. In 15, it was moved to 7.25%. So 125 basis point drop at one time. You can see the corresponding drop in the market value of assets and actual value of assets. So, and then 15 to 16, a lot of write downs that's been fairly steady since then. But the last couple of years has taken a little bit more of a drop.
So you just kind of run through some risk. We're going to get to talk more about payroll. I've kind of hit on investment. There's other stuff built in here, though. You know, we've seen did an experience study for you. You guys, I think it was during 2020, so it would have been through 12/31/2019. We're not due to do that again for a few more years. But, you know, in that next experience study, we are going to capture some of the COVID experience, whether that we see that directly in what's happened with the plan or if there are further kind of long-term implications of that on retirement patterns, turnover patterns, mortality patterns. It's kind of, we've seen some immediate impact, but it's kind of too soon to say what potential impacts there and lingering effects there may be from COVID going forward. So that's kind of a risk factor out there. Obviously, volatility in the market, I mean, that's been the story the past couple years now. Just to say, we're showing you numbers based on one set of assumptions. We know there's a much wider scope of actual realities that will come to fruition, and there is risk involved in that. We try to monitor, we try to put forth our best estimate of the assumptions, but we know anything can happen. Now we get into talking about, we've got a few slides where we're going to talk about payroll projections. You know, actually, I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to jump ahead to this chart, because it kind of breaks down the numbers. You know, the city's hiring plan went into effect in 2017. So what we're showing here is 2017 through 2022. They show you the hiring plan payroll compared to actual valuation computation pay that was in the data. In 2023 and beyond, that projected valuation payroll number is just assuming payroll as of the valuation date goes up with the payroll growth assumption of 2.5%. You can see there, 2017, 2018, 2019, the city was really lagging where they wanted to be with that payroll plan, almost to the tune of close to $20 million in 2019. That has kind of course-corrected over the last few years. You know, in 2022, we're looking at closer to $437 million in total pay compared to the hiring plan of $422 million. So it is back on track. That being said, what's built into that hiring plan? There are still pretty large increases in there. I think the average annual growth in payroll is closer to 3.1% each year. Our valuation assumption is 2.5%. That's why you see this graph projected out in future years, that it looks good for the next couple of years, and then the difference emerges again. And in total, we could potentially be looking at $400 million in pay that doesn't come to fruition, and obviously if there's statutory contributions in place now, once those run out, you know, projected contributions are assumed to equal 34.5% of computation pay, so that's all built into our projections, but could look very different if the city's hiring payroll plan isn't met.
One thing I just wanted to say, maybe I just misheard how you said it, the 3.1% average payroll growth is based on the city's hiring plan payroll. You probably said, maybe I just misheard it, but you know, we assume a 2.5%, they're assuming a 3.1%. So that's the difference. And I think, is it the next page we have the difference in the projected year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is what it looks like. You know, a teal line, that's assuming that hiring plan comes to fruition, and I guess once you hit 2037, then payroll starts increasing at 2.5%. Blue, that's assuming we take the payroll as of 2022 and just increase it with the 2.5% valuation assumption.
Well, why do we assume 2.5% versus the 3.1? There, I mean, should we be in sync with the least on the assumptions?
I think that came out of the last experience study, and that's something that we need to.
So when we lower the assumed rate of return from 7 to 6.5, you split that between the
basically inflation component,
the real rate of return, and then you typically have your payroll assumption match your inflation.
Which doesn't have to. If we think that the payroll growth assumption is being used for individuals, we're projecting their pay not based on the payroll growth assumption, we're based on the salary scale effect.
Right.
So the payroll growth assumption comes into play for the amortization of the unfunded liability for the bases we're setting up and also for the projections we're doing. So if we need to, if you think we need to update that, we certainly can. If it's reality is keeping up with that.
One of the things we might want to update, and I know I explained this when the trustees were here the first time, but that was a while ago. We call the city's hiring plan, you know, like it's this plan for hiring, and it's not. What it is numbers that the city put together in 2017 when we were going through the legislative process, and we've kept with the same numbers. I don't know today what the city's hiring plan is. There's other people that do that are in the room, but, you know, and I'm sure their hiring plan changes all the time. Sherry Kowalski is the controller for the city, for those of you that don't know Sherry.
And I can get that for you out of the budget.
That's fine. And it changes all the time, but what we did was when we did the, we wanted to kind of keep this as the best numbers we had, and we could consider changing it based on what the city thinks. And then we have that true up in 2025, so maybe we want to change what we do with these numbers then. Mm-hmm. But we've always kind of said, okay, where did we think we were going to be? And where are we? So we've used the same numbers. But it's kind of a misnomer.
Seem like we should be in sync to some extent. We're changing our discount rate or our investment rates, and we're changing inflation. So we probably should, I mean, if it's materially different, we would probably want to adjust it. If it's not, you would stay.
Well, and two, you know, looking at this, like I said, the first few years, and I think that's why we have a lot of opportunity, that they were off by about $20 million. And doesn't matter while you have statutory contributions, but once those run out, $20 million compounded over the next 30 years, it's real, you know, you see it on the next page, it's real money. It's been much more in line the last 2 years, and maybe that is, I said, once we kind of get to the unknown wild west of 2025 and beyond, something we revisit in what we're doing.
Yeah, like the next page for a second. So you can see what Kate was starting to go through, if the hiring plan payroll is met and contributions are on that basis, and that's when you're fully funded, expected to be fully funded in 2090. If instead payroll was just 2.5% per year increase, 2090 you're projected to be 64% funded. So that's another reason we were kind of including that to show meeting these payroll projections are vitally important.
Well, I think that's right. I just think if their projections now are much higher than what
right.
these
we can
are,
certainly,
we
yeah.
can try to...
Yeah, that's,
and
that's fine.
Like I said,
yeah.
I think, especially because the first few years they were coming in under, you know, we weren't going to try and mirror that and assume it continued because they weren't meeting those marks. And
yeah.
Like I said, the last couple of years it's been better. They're much more in line. They're
yeah,
meeting
if we have
those.
Updated numbers, we can
yeah.
start using those
sure.
going forward. That's not a problem. I mean, that impacts the projections. That doesn't impact, like, the valuation liability or fund percentage or anything like that.
Well, I don't think, you know, we're looking out through 2090 here, 68 years down the line.
You can't put any...
credibility gets a little fuzzy past 50 years, so...
Yeah, next Thursday, credibility gets a little fuzzy for projections.
Yeah, but the next 5 years.
I mean, the point is that, you know, you can actually see where... hard to see, but you can kind of see where the lines are together through 2024, 2025, whatever it is, because that's where the statutory contributions are still in play. You know, it's after that when they start to spread out. But really, I mean, this is the story here. It's still going to get worse before we start to get better. And we're assuming 34.5% of computation pay is contribution level once statutory contributions run out. That ADEC we looked at was 52% of computation pay. Those are wildly different numbers, and that's why you're seeing a true, fully funded amortization period much longer than the 23 some years built into the ADEC. It kind of gets back to the fund needs more money, and money is unfortunately the main thing that's going to help this graph look different than it's looking.
You can't make. Plan changes to current actives is not going to get you out of this hole. It's just not.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
I said plan changes for current members is not going to get you out of this hole. It's not. Even if you...
investment returns won't get you out of this hole either.
Well,
you got to get them.
That's
something,
they'll
you
help.
Know.
They'll help.
Yeah, certainly.
Outside of a 13% return for 2022, we are assuming just the long-term assumption of 6.5% every year. That's to say, I don't know what the market will do in 2023, but it doesn't assume any sort of market recovery is in there.
What I was just going to point out, as far as talking about ACT, what impacts the ACT is kind of what they're earning. Is that $22.4 million, the fourth line down, the employer normal cost? Even if, and I'm not recommending this, I'm saying even if this plan did a hard freeze and that normal cost went away, the ADEC down there at the bottom is still $228 million. So you take away $22.5 million, still a ton of money. You're still over $200 million. So plan changes alone, and of course liability would be impacted going forward. Once the legislature meets, just want to make sure, and we try to make this clear, they need to know that they cannot just make changes to the plan to right the ship, so to speak. There's no answer except for a lot of money, really. That's what the answer is. And I don't know if you want to go through it or not. There's one page for the supplemental plan.
So the supplemental plan we've talked about, that's for the pay that's above civil service for the chief. And that is the only thing I'm not worried about with this pension fund. And that's because on an annual basis, the city has agreed to fund it at the ADAC. So and there's no smoothing in the plan.
Right.
It's a small plan, so they're able to kind of take the ups and the downs. So that plan will be funded at the end of the period.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the effective amortization period is 16 years. Assuming they continue to contribute that, and like you said, it's
turning
$2.8 million versus $228 million.
Couch cushion change. But yeah, so that's a supplemental plan. It's not pretty. One of these days we'll come in here with great news. Don't know when that'll be, but so I'm hoping. And we're not telling you anything different than you've heard in the past. I mean, we're not trying to sound gloom and doom, but it is what it is, and you guys are all aware of that.
It's
a long-term deal here. We're not going to get out of this in the short term.
So I have a brief presentation that takes the same information and just shows it a different way. It just eight slides, but if you have more questions. Feel free.
So we're done with
They can stay here.
Okay. I'd just like to say thank you. We think you guys do a great job. You bring good clarity to a subject which is oftentimes confusing for people who, like me, who think they're sophisticated. And so I have to always kind of dig down. We agree that at some point there needs to be a large injection, but in order to do that, we need to be able to communicate to everyone that we can be good stewards of that money. And, that maybe wasn't true prior to Kelly and team getting here, but, we really want to be able to communicate that it is, and you guys are a real important part of that. So thank you. I think you guys do a great job, and we appreciate all that you did.
Well, thank you, and we're always available to do what we can. It's not always fun or easy or quick, but we certainly try.
Also, too, I know our full reports are in the materials, so we touched on a small portion of what's in there. If you're looking, you have questions.
Yeah, just reach out.
Jeff and I all over here answer questions.
From a member standpoint, I want to say thank you for coming in here and not blowing smoke in our direction, because I think for many, many years that happened, and honesty and transparency is the only way to get out of this position. I don't think anybody at this table likes what we're seeing. We don't want to be dealing with this, but we are, and we own it. And the only way to get through it is to own it. And thank y'all for coming in here and just putting it all out there for everybody to see,
yeah,
and explaining it in a manner in which it's easy to understand. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. And just to follow up with that, and some of the longer-term board members will tell you, we don't really sugarcoat it. I mean, we're not always the most popular people in the room, but we're not trying to tell you what you want to hear, but what you what it is and what you think you need to hear. Those aren't always the same thing. They haven't been for a while, but it doesn't do any good for us to try to sugarcoat things and not be blunt, because you're not in a position where you can afford sugarcoating. I mean, you've got to hear the straight news. It does you a disservice if we're not straight with you. We tell people that new business presentations or proposals, whatever, you may not always like what you hear from us, but we'll be straight with you. So
I like that. Thank you.
We'll have good news one day. It just might be a while.
You might still be here, but I don't think I'll be here.
Okay. On one page 157 of your packet, the first slide of this small presentation, and what I started doing this a few years ago because I the board wanted to see, well, where did we think we'd be at the end of the year versus where did we end the year? So this first slide shows when they Siegel did the valuation in the prior year, where do they think we would end the next year? And granted, it's much easier to project 1 year than, you know, out to 2090, but it gives us an idea, you know, what happened from what we thought would happen this year to where we are. So this year, as you know, our actual investment income was much higher than we projected. I think we actually projected we had the ramp up in there, so 5.75%. And because we had the big write-up in that energy private equity fund, you're seeing the big increase there. Unfortunately, as we talked about, there's volatility in that, and a lot of times we've seen a pattern of up 1 year, down the next. So hopefully we won't give that back when we get the next numbers from them, but that's what it looks like here. Contributions were on track. Obviously, the city funded exactly what they needed to by law on the employer side. The decrease is just on the employee side, but it's very close. The benefit payments were about 7% less than we expected. I was a little surprised to see that, but we'll keep an eye on that and understand why. And then the admin expenses were lower than we anticipated, and we adjusted the assumption going forward because that's been the consistent pattern, and Jeff talked to that. This is the exact same information. It's our bridge chart. You will actually see three bridge charts today, but they're all a little bit different. This one is actually where did we start 2021 and where did we end 2021 and what contributed to the changes. So we started with $1.9 billion. We added investment gains of $321 million. We added contributions of $224 million. We paid $324 million worth of benefit payments and then $6.4 million in admin expenses. So we ended the year with a bigger number than we started, which was not projected at $2.1 billion. So that's a little bit of good news.
Do you know off the top of your head what the liability did year to year?
I bet they do.
No. Sure, 1 second. So our assets went up by 100 and
it didn't change much.
Well, the liability went from
$214 million.
$5,116,000,000 to $5,159,000,000.
Okay.
So not quite $43 million.
It went up.
Yeah.
So we mined some
progress.
We did a little bit of progress, a little bit of momentum. That's great. That's a little something to be excited about.
It is. It's very exciting. On the next slide is our net benefit payments, and again, you've heard and you know this very well. Every month, every year, we pay out more in benefit payments than we get in. That trend will continue. As you can see on this chart, the negative numbers are more going out than coming in. We actually turned the corner after 2047, and that's when we're no longer paying for some of the higher benefits, and the majority of the benefits that we're paying are at the lower benefit level, and contributions are covering those. And once that turn happens, you know, it feeds into our projected funding percentage. And this is the exact same chart that Caitlin and Jeff showed you, just flipped on its side because I like this chart this way. And you can see here where we're going to drop pretty low. The red line is the 50% funded level, and no one would think that a 50% funded plan is a great place to be, but I think it's a good marker. The bottom of the chart is our funding percentage currently, and you can see there's a big drop-off from 2022 to 2023, and that's that negative 13% we've already baked in for next year. And then it gets worse, stays pretty low for a long period of time before it turns the corner. And that's assuming all assumptions are made, the hiring plan, the rate of return, the retirements, you know, everything. If that hiring plan assumptions aren't met, this is the exact same information, just taking the 2.5% growth rate from where we are. The funding is just, you know, a lot more challenging, and I think at 2090 we're only 68% funded. So we'll continue to monitor that. But as they said, the city's worked very hard to bring those numbers up. They've given significant raises to the employees. They're still challenged, especially in police and hiring, but they've made great strides there. This is the funded percentage comparison. I expected the blue lines to be higher than the red lines because, or the orange lines, because of the investment returns. The blue lines, the blue is the current numbers, the 2022 numbers. The orange is the prior year, and this is just to show the change in the prior year. The solid lines are hiring plan, and then the dashed lines are the payroll growth. And I thought, oh, we're going to be higher, but we aren't higher because you see that blue line right there on the left takes a, you know, dive to the south. That's my 13% in there. Had I not done that, it would have been higher. But I think it's good. You know, it's one advantage to doing the valuation so late. We could see through the year, we probably weren't going to make up where we were in the investments. This conclusion, I'm not going to read it. It just goes through how many years we're below 30% funded under the hiring plan, which is 24. It's a long time to be at a very low funded ratio. It's worse if we're obviously, we don't have the hiring plan numbers. The takeaway, haven't changed for years since this plan was put in place, since HB 3158 was put in place, we had a path to solvency. It was kind of a narrow path, and we knew in 2024, 2025, we had that relook to see where we were and what needed to be done long-term to fix the plan. So that is kind of the same information, but in a different little bit of a take. Are there more questions for me or for Caitlin and Jeff?
Thank you. Once again, clarity. Which is great, and I think it does highlight that the solution involves multiple stakeholders, but we only control what we can control, and that's to be able to represent to people who we might ask to trust us that trust is well placed and that we have a solid ship, and if we were to receive additional funding, that we can be good stewards of it going forward. And that's really all that we can control. So, but you guys painted a great picture. I'm not going to let you be down on yourself as negative. You guys present just the news, I think, is what they're supposed to do.
There's one important thing I forgot to mention. I apologize. So we were required by the Pension Review Board, we and every other pension, to adopt a funding policy a few years ago. And in that funding policy, we're required to have a benchmark of what do we do if the ADC, the actuarially determined contribution, is plus or minus 2% of what we're actually receiving. And if that happens for two valuations in a row, we need to take some action. Well, this is our second valuation in a row that triggers that event. So what it says is, that if we hit that point, we need to let the city know, by the way, the ADC was, the actual contributions were more than 2%, less than the ADC now for 2 years in a row. So we need to notify the city of that. The board must consider whether you make a recommendation to the city or about increasing the contributions. You can decide if you want to do that or not because we have the 2024-2025 process in place. So what I plan to do is bring this back on the December agenda to discuss it more, but that piece is now
Would you just frame that one more time so that we all make sure, because you told us something, you told us something we have to do, so that we can all be mindful. Tell us what we need, in your opinion, what we need to contemplate or what requirement we have.
So we have a requirement to notify the city that their actual contributions are not meeting the ADC within the required benchmark.
Okay, so that's something you will do now. Okay,
yes.
Now that you have the threshold to do that. Okay.
Right, and the board must consider if you want to recommend to the city that they increase their contributions to bring them within line of that 52.3%. And normally I would think a board might want to do that for your fiduciary reason.
So why wouldn't you do that? Yeah.
Right. I mean, you could do it and they could say thank you very much and you fulfilled your obligation. If you want to do that, it does take 8 votes of the board. If you don't want to do that because you know you have this other process already in place, I think that's perfectly acceptable too. But we'll bring that back in.
And when you say other process, you mean?
The statutory required 2024 process where we have to make all of the corrections.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll make that an agenda item.
Yes.
My instincts tell me it's not an or, it's an and. But,
yeah.
Should we also, since it's fiduciary duties, what Bill mentioned, should we have Chuck Campbell kind of sit in next month on that since he's our fiduciary lawyer? Is that necessary, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Chuck, it's been a while, so I think maybe it's a good time to have Chuck come in. I think he hasn't met some of the new trustees, so that's probably a good idea.
Okay. And just for clarification purposes, because you said their contributions, you're talking about the city's contributions.
Absolutely. It's only related to the city's contributions.
Okay.
Right.
I didn't want to include that misconstrued.
Sorry.
No.
Okay. So when we have public comment under this meeting, and then we'll go into the regular session, and once we get to the actuarial item, we'll make the motion there. But you don't need to say that.
For communication's sake, if we do have a proposed motion, I would incorporate that we specifically say we are not requesting anything of the members. I think we should not just clarify by what we don't say, and we should actually have that as part of the motion so that if there's any rumors or whatever, that we're able to say, listen, this is the actual motion. It specifically says our recommendation is on the city's piece, and we're specifically saying we're not making any recommendation on you guys doing anything more. Would you all agree that's smart to do? Yeah. Okay.
So we'll do that, and we'll also make that clear in the communication we make to the city. Okay. Thank you.
All right. So, we have to do public comment. We can do it twice. Do you think we should do the ones now or wait?
It's up to them if they want to speak now or in 2 minutes if the other one.
Okay. All right, let's just do it now. Michael? Nothing? Okay. David?
I'll wait for later.
Okay. Sherry? Okay. All right, so we have a motion.
Is there anybody on the phone?
If they'll place a 5-star on their phone, I'll unmute them if they want to speak.
Okay. All right. So, can I have a motion to adjourn the required public meeting?
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Now we go to the regular meeting. Feels a little awkward, but we had to do it this way. If we can have a moment of silence for all the people that are not with us anymore. Thank you. So now let's move to the minutes of the October 13th meeting. Any comments on those? Okay. Can I have a motion to approve those?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Consent agenda. Kelly, anything you want to flag for us?
No, there's nothing unusual.
Okay. Motion to approve those? Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Public comment. I just want to say one thing beforehand. Something I'm just very mindful of is that the inflation, you know, it's just when people don't have a COLA, you know, and way back when you thought maybe that's a 2 or 3% per year, you know, inflation, high single digits, low double digits, whatever. Very, very mindful that that's something that the beneficiaries have had to deal with, and just something I think about quite a bit when I look at what's going on in our economy and so on. So, Michael, anything you want to say? David? Okay, this is your second last chance.
I understand.
Okay.
Let me just say that I did have something that I wanted to say, but you covered it right there in your last comment. I just want to point out there's a lot of retirees, and I know that when this thing came up in 2017, there were a lot of comments made by police and fire retirees and billionaires that had all this money. There's a lot of retirees that are here on their base pension. They don't have anything to fall back on. And a lot of those people are really hurting right now because they're faced with this inflation. So, but you covered it right there. I'm glad that you acknowledged that there is an understanding that not only these people, they haven't had a raise since 2016, despite the fact that the ERF, they continue to get 5% raises each year. But because we're police and fire, we don't get anything. We don't get anything for the rest of our lifetime. It was at 106. I had to be 106 years old before. I don't think I'm going to make 126. So it's not getting any better. But so now I have had my comment. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, it's real, and it has many faces to it. For people who are on fixed amounts, it's a declining of purchase power, and it has real human manifestations to it. And I just want to know, everyone here is very aware of it. And so, yeah. Sherry?
The same. I think everyone's aware of
great time. All right. Okay, so now we move to the actual value. Okay, we had the actuarial valuation. I guess here we need to approve it.
Right.
So, yeah. So we received. Did anyone have any further thoughts or whatever? Actuarial epiphanies that came to them in the last few minutes. Do you want to go back to these guys on?
So, I lost it at the time machine.
Yeah. Okay. So what we need is a motion to approve the issuance of the January 1st, 2022 actuarial valuation report, subject to final review by our auditors, BDO, and then final review and approval by our executive director. Can we have a motion on that?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. All right. Now, Steve, you're going to talk to us about the professional service provider meeting.
Sure. Marcus and I met with Jeff and Kaylin this morning. And should I wait?
No, you're fine.
And they had nothing but positive feedback about the staff working with the staff at the pension and what they get from responsiveness and the information that they need. We did ask two questions that were needed when they initially started their engagement. It was Jeff, Rocky, and Deborah. Rocky and Deborah have since retired. And so we asked the questions about who supports the pension fund. And so it's Jeff and Caitlin. And they also just confirmed with Siegel they've got a bench strength behind them that does a lot of stuff behind the scenes. And that's really what Deborah did before. She wasn't really meant to do a lot of the client-facing work. Rocky was kind of at a point in his career as well, but he had kind of sunset, so to speak. And Jeff has been the one doing the bulk of the work since their engagement began with the pension fund. So we confirmed that. Then we also asked as well, what's the typical timeline for evaluation from start to finish? Normally it's 6 to 8 weeks. It's been a little bit complicated with the private equity investments. That kind of mess is kind of a moving target for them. but normally we should expect about 6 to 8 weeks for evaluation.
I appreciate you asking those questions. I had asked Melissa to pass that on to you. I do think that they do an excellent job, and I do think that they're critical for us moving forward into 2024 and 2025. But it is a challenge for us with the time it takes to get information. So I'm going to continue to push that they need to add some bench strength there. It's really a challenge for me and Brenda.
Just for refreshing my memory, how much longer do we have Siegel under contract?
Through the 25.
That's what I thought.
And I think it's critical because they know everything, and I do trust their work.
Okay.
It's complicated and it takes a long time, and it needs to be faster.
What would be reasonable in terms of time frame from your perspective?
Well, so. What I'm not an actuary, and I know it's more complicated than I think, but I know they do a lot of the data scrubbing, data checking at the beginning of the year. We get that information to them in January. And then from there, they're only waiting for our final asset number. And the liabilities are already calculated and everything. So it seems like it should be a quicker turnaround. But it's not only on the valuation, but on other requests that we have take a long time if we need a worksheet redone or whatever. Things just take a long time. Because I think Jeff has a lot of clients and things, and they do a lot of quality check, obviously, which we need.
I've never seen a time in my career where accounting professional services firms, there's so few of them for these things that, you know, they really can kind of dictate to you when they deliver things. I don't know what the rest of you guys are seeing, but like accounting firms, you know, and transactions, they say go somewhere else if you don't want it. You don't like our timetable, and it's just that's just the reality of today with a lot of these things.
And they do drop everything. Once we get those numbers, they drop everything and they start working on it. So do the auditors, which, you know, we are not an easy client to work with. So I do acknowledge that. I'm going to keep pushing for more seniors and staff.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Now we're going to move on to Brenda for a second reading. It's not a play. It's not a poem. She's doing a second reading I'm actually going to a play tomorrow night that a friend of ours, they're doing a reading, they're calling it. So I just sort of laugh that you look at a budget and a play and don't use the word a reading of it. So we're ready for our second reading and discussion of the 2023 budget.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate that. As Nick mentioned, last month we had the initial or the first reading of the 2023 proposed budget. Since that time, we have forwarded the budget to the City of Dallas, to their CFO and their controller's office, as well as we posted it on our website. We have not received any direct comments related to the budget from either a member or directly from the city. Sherry and I have had a conversation about it, but there was no comments about changes that they would recommend. So there have not been any changes since you last saw this in October. So I'm just briefly going to review where we are. The total 2023 budget is $18.2 million. And for those of you who are following along on Zoom, I'm on page 182. And that $18.2 million is compared to $21.7 million for the 2022 budget. That's down almost $3.5 million or 16%, and that decline is primarily driven by declines in management fees. And when you compare the 2022 projected actual with our 2023 budget, we're down about $577,000 or 3%, And that decline is primarily driven by investment-related expenses that are partially offset by some increases in professional and administrative expenses. So that's just a brief overview of the more in-depth review that we did last month. Are there any questions about the budget?
On investment expenses, is there any of our investments like private equity or so on where the kind of expense is at the asset level, like where there's carried interest or anything like that? Or is this reflect truly the difference between kind of gross and net in all situations?
Yeah, so the investment expenses that, that we see in the budget here are ones that are legal expenses, so there's been a lot of legal that has gone through for Lone Star, for HEF, and that is what is affecting the...
No, but like the management fees that one of our Invesco or someone has is in here in the investment number, right?
Well, we report those net. They're not, they're in the management fee line.
But they're, but they roll up to these investment expense total.
Yes, it's,
okay.
It's in the investment expense.
Yeah, so my question is, are there any deducts, like you might have a carried interest or something, that are at the asset level that don't run through the P&L?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, there are. So when the management fees for, say, Invesco, they don't run through, but Makita would.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So you're talking
that's
about
consulting fees.
Right, but in right, but most of management fees don't run through the P&L. We have to. We didn't use the budget for them, but we because they get reported at net, and we don't send a wire to pay those. We
no,
do send a wire
but
to
are,
pay.
Are they reflected in?
Yes, they are reflected in those numbers.
Yeah, they are reflected.
They're reflected in the budget. They're not reflected in the financial statements.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are in the budget for sure.
This is cost accounted. There's no way carried interest is back to do this because it would require a projection, right? For investment fees?
Well, I'm just looking at like historical.
It's been incurred, I think, from the realizations.
Yeah, when you look at historical, that was just my question. Are there any elements of investment expenses that are that don't flow through this number?
Carried interest would, right?
Well, I just want to get confirmed, so...
Yeah, there hasn't. We haven't had any carried interest in a while.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're aware of. Yeah. I mean. Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. So, can we have a motion to approve this 2023 budget?
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, Brenda, quarterly financial reports, and then you can go into talking about the financial audit status.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to start the third quarter financial review with a bridge chart, as Kelly mentioned. You'll see several of those today. The bridge chart represents the change in net position over the period by adjusting the investment, benefit, and operations-related transactions during the period to arrive at the ending net position. So we began the year with a preliminary net position of $2.18 billion. We had investment-related transactions of $330 million, and benefit and operations-related transactions of $82 million, both of those things decreased net position, and our preliminary ending net position is $1.76 billion, down $412 million since the beginning of the year.
Does this reflect the HUF write-up? It's already in these numbers.
Yes, so it would be in the beginning number. The 12/31/2021.
It's in the beginning number.
And then,
but when you see the third bridge chart of the day, it won't be in that beginning number because this is financial and the other is Makita. So.
And then when you when we've received cash distributions, that number is in the
yeah, it's in the 330 net, right?
Yeah.
So up or down, whatever we made there.
Can I go back, Ryan? Can we just confirm that when we see the investment expenses on the budget, that that includes, like, all manager fees, all that, everything in that?
Uh-huh. See?
Okay.
Yes. So it's the full bucket for management fees. You know, we're budgeting.
Yeah. It's fund level fees and fees we pay direct. We split that out in the financials, right?
Right.
But everything that is paid at, you know, private equity fund level, anything that's directly management fee or carried interest gets included there.
Okay. So basically, the difference between gross and net is reflected in that number, and there's nothing that would be a difference between gross and net that would not be in that number.
The only thing that is not included in the net number is, like, that's investment related is the custodian and the consultant.
But those appear somewhere else.
Those appear as part of the operating.
Okay. So does everyone, so what we're operating under the assumption that you're saying that of all of our assets, we have gross returns, and then we have our net returns and net positions. The difference between that, the expense burden that we pay third parties, management, carried interest, is reflected in Brenda's number for investment expenses that's on the budget. So there's not some other bucket of expenses or netting out that we're not reflecting.
Yeah, the only two things are...
Okay.
But it's not in the financials because you're net getting the net returns, I guess. So why do we budget for it then?
Because the state law changed a few years ago that requires us to budget for all investment expenses.
That's a good reason.
It's good to label everything.
It's
cash outflow.
And the management fee budget's difficult because obviously most of it depends on asset value, but
sure.
We like to look at, like, the percentage. You know, we have that in the annual report. What was our percentage this year compared to last year as a percentage of AUM, and we break it down by asset class as well. And was it about 63,
mm-hmm.
I believe?
Okay. All right. Sorry. It's good.
No.
Yeah. Just wanted to clarify.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. So we ended 9/30/2022, our preliminary net position at $1.7 billion. So that was page 189, again, for folks who might be following along. Moving to page 190, we're going to look at the statement of fiduciary net position. And this report combines the results from September 30th, 2022, to the preliminary results from December 31st, 2021. The first section is investments. The total investment value at September 30th was $1.65 billion, and that compares to $2.1 billion at 12/31. Or a decrease of $452 million since the end of the year. And the largest component of this change were equity securities, fixed income, and real assets. So as we look at fixed income, it decreased by $164 million since year-end. $60 million of that was rebalanced into cash or the safety reserve. $5 million rebalanced into equity, and the remainder of the decline is related to changes in the market during this year. As we look at equity securities, down $252 million since year-end. This decrease is, again, primarily related to the changes in the market during the year. The last item I'll look at in the investment section is real assets. It's declined by $25.4 million. We've received distributions from AEW of $17.8 million and $3.8 million from J.P. Morgan Maritime. That accounts for most of the decline in this account, and the remaining decline is related to valuation changes since the end of the year. As we move down the schedule and we look at receivables, the city and member contribution receivable decrease is primarily related to the number of days accrued at the end of the period and an increase in the per-day average payroll. At the end of December, we accrued 10 days, and at the end of September, we only needed to accrue 3 days. So there's your change there. As we continue to move down the schedule, we look at cash and cash equivalents. They have decreased by $9 million since the end of the year, and that decrease is related to cash used to pay benefits during the period. And finally, on the schedule, if we look at accounts payable and accrued liabilities, they're down by almost $1.2 million since the end of the year. That's primarily due to the payment of expenses after year-end, and the largest portion of that was related to fund management fees, which are down $1.2 million since the end of the year. Next, I'm going to look at the changes in fiduciary net position. So if we go to the next page, that's page 191. Net investment income declined by almost $427 million year over year. The net appreciation and depreciation in the fair value of investments accounted for most of that decline, and that was $422 million. And again, this change is primarily driven by the downturn in the market during 2022. As we move down the page into the deduction section and we look at benefits paid to members, overall benefits paid to members increased by almost $6.3 million year over year. Service pensions increased by $4 million. Survivor benefits increased by $2.5 million, and those increases were partially offset by a small decline in disability payments of $260,000 when you compare that to the same period last year. And the primary driver of the increased benefits is just a new service retirement at higher monthly benefits than in the prior period. Are there any questions about the financials? Okay. I will move on to the last item, which is the audit update. With receipt of the final outstanding financial statements last month, we were able to send the DCFP financials to the actuary. This morning, Siegel presented the actuary report. Now that we have those reports, we'll be able to forward them on to BDO, and we expect to be able to complete DCFP's financials in the next 30 days. So at the December board meeting, you should see the year-end financials for DCFP. At that time, and also we're working on our annual comprehensive financial report, and we'll be presenting a draft of that report as well at December. Are there any questions about the audit stat?
Kelly, required training, manual delivery.
All right. So this is another oddity that came about in the legislation. The executive director is required to provide the trustees a training manual annually, and I'm required to get a written acknowledgement from you that you've received it. So the way we've done this is I've taken screenshots, actually, rather than logging in to show you what it looks like. It's available in your Diligent in your resource center, and depending on what you're logging on, it either says resource center or res center. The difference between the computer and the iPad. But here's where you see it. On the left, you can see Resource Center. And there are items under here. The second one is the board training manual, which is what we're talking about. Well, one thing before I show you what's in there, I wanted just to let you know, the next item is a blackout list. So if we're in a search process, that will tell you who you are not supposed to be communicating with. We do update that every month or sooner if necessary. The fourth item, though, I think is very helpful. It's prior board meeting presentation. So if you're wondering what the Siegel presentation looked like 2 years ago or what Makita said 3 months ago, or what BDO said, or what AEW said. Those presentations are all here, and they're sorted by the vendor name or who gave the presentation versus date. So it's an easy way to find things if you're looking. So I wanted to just
think about that. You said, Kelly, blackout list. How, that's updated monthly?
Yeah, every month.
So it, like,
I mean, should you, Ryan, be reporting that to us at the board meetings rather than us having to go dig through the
report? I mean, typically it's only for a search and it's the people that we're,
right.
we're talking to. But,
yeah, no,
yeah we should probably practically do that. And, like,
yeah.
this last month there was no searches, so it didn't update month to month.
Good.
So
you
we
probably
have,
should
you know.
Clarify
yeah.
that into your report so that we don't miss something by mistake. And
definitely.
Okay.
We'll do that with IAT, too.
Yep.
Good idea. So if you click on that board training manual item, you'll see there's 8 chapters, and those 8 chapters are required in the statute. The statute number's there, and it tells you exactly what needs to be in there. So the 8 chapters are there, laid out for you. If you click on any of these items, you can see on the next pages the types of information that are in there. So it's like the plan document and the budget and various rules and the open records rules and some training on alternative investments. So you can see all of the information that's here. Most of it doesn't change year to year other than the budget and the audit. And if there's changes in the legislature, you'll see those items there. But that's available to you, and now it's been delivered.
We call it visual melatonin.
So if you wouldn't mind citing that acknowledgement, and what we decided to do this year is we also need you to acknowledge that you've seen the ethics policy. So now we're combining it into one document so we don't forget to do the ethics one. If you need an ethics policy, let me know. I know we just went over it with the new trustees.
So the acknowledgement is that you received it, not that you're confirming you've read it, because we haven't, yeah.
Exactly.
So
you just have to receive it. I just have to give it.
Yes.
And we're giving it electronically.
Of course we'll go through it.
All right, so if you sign those and leave them, that would be great. And Nancy will send the email.
We'll host a pizza party, and we'll all get together and talk about it.
Okay. The next item is the monthly contribution report. And as you heard in the prior presentations, city's done a good job. We're on track, and there's really nothing unusual in this report, so I don't need to go through it unless anybody has any questions.
Well, you showed us your chart already, so you got me snuffed
out.
That's
all I
before.
Have.
Okay. you want to go through the board, the travel?
Yeah. So starting on page, looks like 206 is the classes that Carol has put out for you. These are the TechSPERS and NCPERS trainings that are coming up in 2023. If anybody's interested in attending any of these or need more information, you can let Carol know, and we'll add you to the agenda to get board approval.
The only thing I would say is that if there's, like, ever some good articles that are in some of these industry, you know, things that about, you know, things that are relevant to us, just send them out to us. That, I think
okay.
that's as good a training as anything.
That's good.
Yeah.
Do that. I think the NCPERS Public Safety Conference is actually very good, and I don't know if they're doing the funding forum. Yeah, but that one's, oh, yes, that one in August. That's actually, I think, the best NCPERS training. But with that, I think the next item we have is
Ken, do you get to talk about one you attended?
Yeah. It was public safety and CEPERS in Nashville. First time they had public safety in 3 years. They did a really good job, I thought, on directing it just for public safety. Reps from all over the country were there. TechSPERS had a big presence there. One thing I noticed this time, it was different than previous ones. There was a lot of law firms there that weren't only just attending. They were sponsoring. They were exhibiting. And I wasn't the only one that noticed that. I mean, some of the other reps noticed that. Even one of the law firms asked me, are there usually this many law firms at these training conferences? I said, not, you know, the ones I've attended in the past. There's always a core group of them. But this one had several law firms I've never even heard of. So I don't know if that's sending out a message that, you know, police and fire like to litigate more. I don't know. But there was more than usual there. As I said, it was designed for public safety, and they used an example of New Jersey State Police and Fire Pension Fund that kind of turned their system around. They did a really good job of changing a lot of things
lot of things they did change is stuff that we've done prior to 2017 and then things that we've done after 2017. One thing they got is a lot of the politics out of their board, out of the pension system, and they changed their board around a little bit. One of the changes was rather than have, like we have, you know, these guys that are appointed by the associations, they're required to have their unions assigned to board because New Jersey is a very union state. So they're required to have two police unions that are representative of the state and two fire unions there. So, like I said, they did a good job turning it around. They're now at 71% funded, so they're doing a good job. There's a lot of good classes. There were three that really stuck out in my mind that I really liked. One was put on by TerraCap Management, the owner Steve Hagenbuckle, common spelling. He did a very good talk on how things have been in the past, where we're headed to. He even pointed out that CalSTRS is the largest pension fund in the country. Even though they had a lot of good returns on their public equity and real estate, they were still down 1.3% as of June of 22. But I talked to him a lot after the class. I mean, I really liked his presentation and then just his one-on-one that we talked about. And DART is one of his clients also. So he has connections here in the area. They talk a lot about health care issues for retirees, which, you know, is nothing that we're going to get into. But, you know, one of them was how to set up a trust fund for health care for retirees. Another good class was on the federal legislation. The biggest one that comes up every session is doing away with the windfall elimination. Now, I know the Firefighters Association, they sent out a letter saying that this is in the process of Congress and Senate doing away with it. And it, to put it mildly, it's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, it's just not. They're just, you know, yeah, they had 280 sponsors to both bills, and it's bipartisan. Republican congressman one year or files it, and then a Democratic senator files it also. But it would cost $180 billion and take a year off of Social Security trust fund. So it's just not going to happen. So what might happen that will help, you know, first responders, you know, that we'd have to look into would be the $3,000 tax break they get every year for their health benefits. They're hoping through legislation that goes up to $6,000 because obviously health care costs have gone up, you know, over the years, and $3,000 has been that way from the beginning. So what might pass is that being turned into $6,000 and then it being indexed every time after that. Another good class was on capital dynamics, individual by Joe Marks. He was talking about public equity secondaries, and I never knew anything about public equity secondaries, but he said there's a lot of benefits of it, cash flows, J-curve mitigation, strong diversification, lower risk, opportunistic.
Is that private equity secondary?
Private equity secondary.
Okay, not public. Okay.
Right, private equity secondary. So I wanted to talk with him afterwards, but I couldn't get a hold of him because, you know, we're looking at public markets within a few years. And I'd be interested to learn a little bit more about secondaries. I don't know if there's any white papers out there, Ryan, you can look into.
Yeah, we'll find them. We've actually talked to IT about it in September as an idea to kickstart the private equity program and get some, you know, broader diversification. So
okay.
It's on the radar for sure.
Okay. Now, Leo's not online, right?
He should be.
Okay. Leo, I noticed in one of your papers or emails you sent us, you talked about private equity hybrid plans. Is that the same thing or is that different?
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me well?
We can hear you.
Great. In our materials for this meeting, the hybrid refers to an approach where there is a combination of fund of funds and direct fund investments. So that's what that hybrid refers to. I agree with the comment about secondaries being an area worth considering for you since you have a gap in past years with no commitments? It would mitigate the J curve and it can provide good exposure and diversification right away. So it is, in our mind, probably one of your best options to get jump started back into private equity.
There's a lot of supply right now, too. There's a lot of public pensions are over-allocated to private equity.
Right.
Because public markets have changed, and so there's a kind of flushing going on right now. So timing-wise, it's pretty interesting because there's a lot of supply.
So, yeah, if you could send me or if anybody has any information on secondaries, I'd like to study up on that for our, you know, over the next year, and we're looking at getting back into the private markets.
Yeah. I mean, like the stuff we sold out of the private equity portfolio in 2016, we sold to Harbor Invest, who runs a secondary fund. So
okay.
You know, we were on the other side of the transaction
right. Okay.
Years ago.
Okay. Good. And Leo was there. Enjoyed visiting with Leo several days at Safers. And none of our other, you know, individuals that we deal with were there other than some of the Texpers folks. And they had a lot of good information also. But as far as Nashville goes, if you're a country western singer and you don't have a bar, restaurant, honky-tonk in Nashville, you're losing money. But other than that, like I said, and Seepers did a really good job on directing this just for public safety. It was a very good conference.
Got it. All right, great. Ryan.
All right. Portfolio update. Start with the blackout list. There's no one on it this month, but post it. So liquidation of private market assets remains a top focus. We're up to $100 million received year-to-date. I think we've been fortunate to have the level of distributions coming out of the private portfolio that we've had given the market downturn. We've gotten quite a bit in the last few months, and we're actually getting $26 million today from AEW. And that's a combination of a few land sales they've got done over the last few quarters. So we're in the drawdown mode on the safe reserve that we've been there since March. We'll cover that a little bit more. On rebalancing, just recap a few actions we took in the last month or so. We transferred $30 million over from IRNM, short-term core bond manager, into cash to replenish cash, which is kind of how the safe reserve drawdown works, where we are taking money from IRNM into cash and then cash to pay benefits. We funded the new EM debt manager, Ashmore, at the end of September. We got $57 million back from them and funded, or $57 into MetLife. We got about $53 back from Ashmore. So since August, we've gotten $47 million back in private market distributions that, based on the discussion we have with the IAC and the board over the summer, we can rebalance that into public equity. What we're proposing to do is to take $26 million of that and put that into small cap and pull $21 million of what we received back in the safe reserve. And I got some detail on what that looks like, but that would give us enough money in the safe reserve to extend it out through the end of 23. So we're taking some of the money, putting it back, and holding a little bit back. So what will happen from here, I'll inform the IAC probably later today or tomorrow of the plan. We'll get their concurrence with it, and then we'll go forward with that action. Year-to-date return on the overall portfolio is down 5.5% and then down 15.2% for the public market portion, which is 60% of the portfolio. All right, this is bridge chart number 3. And the difference here in what we're looking at compared to what you saw earlier is from the investment portfolio standpoint, Makita, the official performance is on a quarter lag in the private market. So the starting point here is 1.991 does not include the Q4 write-ups that occurred in private equity. So everything's on a quarter lag, and this is the official performance number. We ended the month with $1.79 billion in AB, and that's down 5.5%. So, and if you look back at our 2021 official return on the quarter lag, it was 5% compared to, I think, the 14 that Siegel calculated. So it's a timing difference of when the Q4 numbers are being included. Looking at the equity market drawdown as of a couple days ago, and we're down about 20%, 20 to 22 on U.S., global, and domestic markets with the EFA, and then EM and NASDAQ, or NASDAQ being tech U.S., down quite a bit more. you look today, as opposed to the board meeting last month, we were down 3% because of inflation. I think markets are up 3.5 to 5% today. So quite a big jump today. Hopefully there's a reverse like it did last month or for today. So this is a new chart that we included this month, just to put some context around the current drawdown and historical bear market drawdowns. If you go to the far right on this chart, it's showing average duration of a bear market in months and then the average drawdown of a bear market. So average drawdown is 41% and average duration is 20 months. The current drawdown is at 9 months and down a peak of 25%. If you look at kind of post-World War II average, take out the Great Depression, average is down 35 and 14 months compared to the current, which is down 25 and 9 months. And the chart on the left is showing what return level is required in the S&P to get back up to peak. So we don't know when that can occur or how much longer the drawdown will last, but it's showing that go-forward returns look fairly attractive, assuming we're getting back to peak at some point in the next 5 years, which likely. Looking at public market performance, overall, October was a very good month. Public portfolio was up 5% compared to 60-40 benchmark of 3.4. Looking at our equity manager, Boston Partners performed very well, up 12.3%. Outperformed the benchmark by quite a bit. Small cap performed quite well, too, in October. Looking at year-to-date, biggest, you know, kind of the value and growth thing we've been talking about, definitely present there with Boston Partners outperforming by 12 and Invesco underperforming their benchmark by quite a bit. We have a review of the public equity portfolio, so we'll definitely go into more detail on that a bit later today. One thing I want to point out, on if you look at the three-year numbers, and this is through October, a lot of the numbers we're going to talk about later are through Q3, but the global equity portfolio is about even to the benchmark of the ACWI over the three-year period, 4.6 compared to the 4.8. And then EM equity with RBC is outperforming their benchmark over the three-year. So when we talk about public equity, it's a combination of those two that looks at the return. So it really will go into more detail, but the EM exposure is bringing that public equity number down a little bit. We actually saw some positive returns in the fixed income portfolio for the first time in a while in October. Mike, can you give an update on the Pacific ownership?
Yeah, so Pacific Asset is our bank loan manager. They had some news come out recently, last couple weeks, that they were sold to Aristotle. So Pacific Asset Management is owned by Pacific Life, the insurer. They sold the asset management business to Aristotle, which is primarily an equity manager, investment manager. So I guess we talked to Makita about it. They were favorable on the acquisition. There seems to be benefits to both sides. We feel comfortable. We spoke with Pacific for about an hour with their new CEO. I can go into the process if anybody has questions on that, but I think the key points are it's beneficial to both sides. Pacific got to increase their ownership amount through the transition, and the CEO and all the PM currently at Pacific cannot be ousted at Aristotle.
I would just add, we were at American Airlines, we were a very burly and large client of Aristotle, very good firm, smart people at the top. Their portfolio managers are much more aligned than they would be in an insurance company in terms of benefits. So I think it'll be a real positive ownership change in terms of that group.
All right, looking at the safety reserve, currently at $139 million between cash and short-term core bonds compared to target of $152. As I mentioned, with holding the $21 million of cash back in cash and not reinvesting that, that would put us at enough money in the safety reserve to it could have to cover benefit outflow through the end of 23. And without doing that, it would be, you know, kind of a October 2nd, so that gives us 2 more months of runway in the state's reserve. And with that, it's looking at the cash on the bottom right, I expect that we'll have enough cash that we don't have to tap back into IRM until sometime maybe in Q2 next year. Looking at the asset allocation, I guess worth pointing out with some money going back into public equity shortly here. Overall, we're still underweight when you look at the combination of global equity, EM equity, and private equity compared to the target of 65 total to those three. And then this just details the plan rebalancing. So the $26 million we just got back from AEW, we would split that between the U.S. and international small cap. We funded both those mandates earlier over the last year, and the plan was to initially fund them halfway and then fill them back at the target. And of the active manager, small cap is one of the worst year to date, and they're also the most underweight to the target. So, any questions on general portfolio before we get into the rest of the agenda? So next item we have, and Lee will chime in a little bit later on this, is private market considerations. We talked about this a few times over the last few months at the board. We had a discussion with the IEC in September to get some investment ideas on the table. But big picture, we have not made a new private market investment since 2016 due to the over-allocation issue. And I'm on 223 of diligence. Long-term targets to private markets are 15%, 5% to real estate, 5% to natural resources, which is ag portfolio, 5% to private equity. At our current asset levels, that's about $90 million each in each one of these asset classes. Right now, we're at 35%. Looking at the go-forward, I think it's possible that sometime in 23 we drop below that target of 15. Given that we haven't made a new investment since 2016, there's a whole lot of planning, resources, processes that I want to have in place before we're making new investments. So this discussion is meant to kind of have to be that initial discussion, get some feedback on some key items, and then start the process going forward to get everything put in place to be making new investments at some point in 23.
Just a question.
Yeah.
On the private, private investments, are we looking at it, when I look at what happened before I got here, where we made investments in single assets, and to me at least that was a little interesting. Are we looking at doing that when we talk about these three type of asset classes, where we would be potentially the sole owner of these investments? Or are we looking at something that is a little bit more diversified?
Definitely more diversified fund investments in the ag portfolio with Manuel at Hancock. We have multiple direct properties in that portfolio, and we plan to keep that. But anything on real estate, we don't plan to do any direct investments into a single property going forward. And, you know, there might be a few investments within our legacy portfolios with Clarion or AEW where we reinvest in a property.
Ryan, it would be fair to say that we would go into limited partnerships in targeted asset classes where there would be other similarly suited LPs like us, so there would be other fiduciary plans, and so the whole concept of suitability, which I think was what you're speaking to, that where we're the only investor, I think is largely an unsuitable investment for us, irrespective of whether it was good people, good ideas, whatever, that we would go into these things that are appropriate for funds like us as sort of an initial screen before we get into
confidence. We would also limit what percentage of the fund we would be to something like 10%.
Yeah.
So we are not going to be the big guy controlling everything. We would be more diversified.
Yeah, we have some restrictions that are already in the IPS, and I have a page on that in a minute, but I want to review that with IAC and make sure we're comfortable with those limitations that we have. So this is a snapshot of the current private market portfolio. I guess what to point out here is we have a pretty big exposure within three big assets in the portfolio. Or, you know, it's Huff, it's Lone Star, it's AEW. Until we get money back from, you know, and we're getting a meaningful money back from AEW right now, but until, you know, Huff or Lone Star sells, we're not going to be below that target. Until we get more money back from AEW, we're not going to be below the target in real estate. So we don't have perfect foresight on when it's going to occur, and like with Huff, if, you know, we get a surprise and he sells the last remaining asset, we could be there quicker than we expect. So it's going to be lumpy coming back.
What year vintage is Huff?
What?
What year vintage is the Huff aggregate?
2008.
Okay. So we restructured. Time. When's the next maturity or due date? Termination.
I mean, the fund is in termination now. It's in liquidation.
Okay.
There's one remaining asset in that fund. It's past the fund term. It's in a sales process. It's been in a sales process for 3.5 years, I feel like. So
that's all going to come back on disposition of just that asset?
That's going to come back at one time.
Wow.
And I don't know if it'll be that number, but when it comes back, it'll come back at one time.
There might be a holdback.
You know, it might be a holdback, but it is one single asset remaining, one company in that portfolio that's left. This is looking at our allocation to private markets over time. We were up to over two-thirds at one point. The spike that you're seeing kind of at the end here is the denominator effect of public values being down, and then the Q4 write-ups, and mainly enough that drove it up. But it's feasible that sometime in 23 we could drop below that target. So high-level considerations we want to discuss with you guys on the private market portfolio. Highest-level consideration is, does it still make sense for us to do private markets given the funding and liquidity situation? Staff and Makita think that it does. We have a long-term allocation to it. But before we move forward and get everything rolling, we want to reconfirm that commitment to that we're actually willing to do it.
I mean, we did the asset allocation in 2017, I think, with Makita, right?
Yeah.
So it's not an old allocation at the 5, 5, 5, 15% number. It was done in 2017.
Yeah, we updated it.
So we need
it
to reaffirm that. Yeah.
Yeah, we updated it last summer, but just wanted to make sure that we're all comfortable moving forward before we start moving forward. Second, do we have the appropriate risk controls? We talked a little bit about that in the IPS. On what we're going to do going forward, what should the board review approval process look like on private markets, what should the consultant's role be in the private markets portfolio, and I have a page on each one of these. I'll come back to this revisit at the end to get any additional insight. And then when should we start putting new money back into private markets? So the provisions in the IPF on the private market portfolio, number one is we're not going to direct investments or co-investments in the portfolio. Two, we cannot own more than 10% of an interest in any private equity fund. Given the commitment size we're looking at, I think that would restrict any funds kind of sub $90 million on the private equity side. So I don't expect that to be an issue. No fund will exceed 2% of the DPFE portfolio. I don't expect that to be an issue either. And then any fund family, if we're doing, you know, multiple investments, series of funds, won't be above 5. I think what we want to look at on the last two is clarify if it's 2% of market value or 2% at commitment. I think it's going to be more clear that level on what the maximum commitment to a fund or a series of funds would be. And then the fifth, and this is in the current IPS. Fifth provision there is that these do not prevent the board from making additional contributions into investments in the current portfolio. So we just wanted to clarify that we have a portfolio of legacy investments, and if they need capital, we're able to reinvest in them as needed. And then per the bill, the state law, a vote of 8 trustees is required to approve any alternative investment. And it's super majority, and it doesn't matter. You know, 2/3 of the total number of board members. So it doesn't matter if we only have 7 here, we get a majority vote. So just be aware of that. Going forward, what I want to do on this item is bring it back to IAC and Makita sometime in probably the next 2 meetings, get some input, and then bring back any changes in clarification language on it that we want to have.
you for back. Because that third point can get tricky, right? I mean, I don't know that you want to give the mix of determining market value and having it potentially trim. Could you solve it another way and just by saying some percentage of cost of the private equity portfolio as opposed to the overall portfolio?
Yeah, that's where, like, I think if we say 2% of the commitment size will not be greater than 2% of the time of investment, but that would prevent us from having to sell something because of the concentration.
Yeah, that works. Okay.
And we might want to look at that too. Like in real estate, we might do a big open-ended fund to get broad exposure. And I don't think we'd want to go more than two, but that's where we could push up against that too. As opposed to private equity, we'd be doing much smaller commitment size. So the approval process, like when we do a search on public markets, we go out to public equity, there's 100 managers in large cap, and we whittle it down, and we interview, send an RFP to seven of them, we interview four of them, and bring a few to the ISC. And I'm going to focus more on private equity. The process is going to look a lot different than that. We're going to have a pacing plan with the consultant that we talked to you guys about. We're going to be looking maybe for three or four commitments, you know, into these areas of private equity, and it's going to depend on what we've underwritten, what Makita, the consultant's underwritten, what's in the market at the time in that year. So we're not really doing a broad net search to look at, you know, X number of funds. It'll probably be, we're looking at two or three funds in a space we want to invest in, and we're just going to bring one for approval. I think, you know, we've done some initial work on a pacing plan with Makita on what it would look like at the asset level, the 5% target we're talking about, private equity. I think it could be 4 to 6 new commitments of about 6 to 9 a year to get to that 90 million level with the diversification you want, with vintage year and commitment size being consistent. So that could be, you know, it's multiple new investments per year. Given the cadence of the IAC only meeting quarterly, I don't know if we're going to be able to bring every new investment versus IAC.
You should be able to. I mean, I was on the railroad board, which is $26 billion, and they had a private equity portfolio of $2.6 billion, and it required their trustees to approve everything, and they only met quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these things, when they go out to raise funds, it's going to take them 6 to 12 months. So you've got a lot of time within a quarter to review it with the IAC and bring it to the board. And I think the board should have a comfort that the IAC has looked at it. But that part I think you can easily do.
Okay. So, and the two models we talked about, and I've talked to Nick a little bit about this too, is, you know, you could have the IAC and a board approve an annual plan. They include, you know, 4 commitments of $10 million each, and there's discretion to pick the funds from there. Doesn't sound like that's the route we want to go. I think we can definitely bring everything to the board. I don't think we're bringing a manager in to meet with the board.
No.
It's a write-up on the fund, the diligence package that we talk about. And I think if for whatever reason we aren't able to get in front of the IAC quarterly, we can always send an email out and talk to them in between. We need to. So I think the route we go is the board has to approve everything, the APOs, and then we'll try to get everything in front of the IAC either at the quarterly meeting or if it's in between meetings, we'll ad hoc it or send a notification out to, here's what we're going to take to the board in October. Let us know if you want to convene to talk about it or review. I mean, you're the chair of the IAC bill. Is that okay to you, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're going to have plenty of time to bring it to the IAC on a quarterly basis.
Okay.
Because it just takes so long to raise a fund these days.
Okay.
So I think that's what the plan should be. And if there's an emergency, some real critical investment, but at these sizes, nothing's going to be that critical, I don't think.
And it's a ways off. Once we get into it, we start doing it. If there's challenges that come up, we'll figure them out from there.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So the consultant role in the private market portfolio. So we hired Makita in April 2018. When we hired them, we were way over allocated to private markets, and we did not expect to do anything over the near term, which we have not done. So we did not hire them to provide direct services on the private portfolio. In their contract, they can do pacing plans and searches on privates for an ad hoc fee. They definitely have private market capabilities. We just did not need them on that front when we hired them. They're coming up at the five-year mark in 2023. We think it's prudent to do some level of RFP on the consultant to figure figure out mainly like what we want to do on the private market side, what that cost is going to be, what is the level of service, are we going to rely a whole lot on the consultant to help us out, are we going to do a lot of it on our own, you know, what level involvement do they have, and what is the cost going to be. So we're also going to address the need for, depending on what the model looks like, and I think level of consultant involvement, if we need any additional internal resources on the team. So I think probably looking at it sometime in Q2 to get started on that process, but what we're thinking there is maybe a subcommittee of the board and the IAC to help us go through assessment of the current consultants, what it looks like on RFP, timeline, how we go about doing that.
You probably will need additional resources internally because these investments, even though they're 15% of the portfolio, take a lot of time, a lot more than the other ones do.
I am. We've had unique situations on our, but you know, that's been the case on our portfolio. Yeah. And then when to initiate new investments, we don't really know when it's going to occur, but our recommendation would be not to make any new investments until you're at least below 20% in private markets and you're trending towards that 15. So we think that, you know, at earliest, that's probably sometime at the end of next year, 23, could occur earlier, but, you know, we basically laid out the timeline here. We want to make sure we get all the feedback from the board, all the processes in place, any tweaks to consultants' role, everything defined, and I'd rather be early to have everything done than be chasing our tail. So,
okay.
I'll go back to this slide here, open it up for any discussion.
Yeah, just a couple points. You know, in this area, we have a lot of scar tissue, and if we dig underneath that scar tissue, we have more scar tissue. and so, you know, I think that I commend Ryan and the team for getting ahead of this issue where the easiest thing to do is to say, you know, kind of put your hand, your fingers in your ears and, you know, and say, I don't want to listen to this. It is an appropriate asset class. It is a way to generate alpha, and I think it is appropriate to outline a process to kind of get back on track with it. That being said, and Ryan and I have talked a lot about this, this is kind of, you know, for you know, someone that does it, you know, this is like the most fun thing you get to do, is sort of do this kind of stuff, and that we just need to go very slowly, be very prudent, and make sure there is, you know, majority consensus buy-in on every step of the process with, you know, extreme kind of input of the IAC, but then all of you. No one, you know, anyone that has any sort of dissenting or negative view on any step of this, you need to speak up. Because we can't say we're not going to do it because of the history, and it's good of Ryan to get ahead of this well beforehand. That, you know, there's a lot of differences in this asset class. You know, for instance, you know, I run a family office, and if we're going to hire an equity manager, we'd probably look at the same universe of people that Dallas Police and Fire does. But on the private capital side, there's probably nothing that's appropriate for them that we would do, and all the things we do probably wouldn't be appropriate for them. So it just comes down to kind of a suitability issue. So the whole discussion of Makita or anyone, what role they play relative to what staff does versus the universe of things we address, how we delegate, you know, sort of tactical responsibilities and so on, is something that everyone kind of needs to move together from concept to implementation. And I just can't stress that, you know, enough. But I do commend Ryan and team for getting ahead of this, saying, you know, we're kind of 6-9 months before we're going to be super serious about it, because now is the time. And he's done a great job. Another thing I want to flag is that, you know, that I read something in the private equity world, I think that the third quarter was the first quarter in, like, forever where there was negative cash flow, meaning that LPs put more money in as capital calls than they received as distributions. I don't know what that looks like on a year-to-day basis, but I did read that for the third quarter. This year, we are wildly positive, right? I mean, our capital calls have been
near modest.
We've generated $100 million or so of cash. That is, you know, we're used to seeing all sorts of things where we're in that whatever quadrant was the worst quadrant on whatever statistic. On this particular thing, that's an amazing accomplishment, and I really commend everyone, but particularly, you know, Ryan and the team for that. That's huge. If we didn't have that $100 million of liquidity, we'd be a lot more kind of tight about, you know, the safety reserve would be a lot lower. That $9 million of negative cash flow would just, you know, be a very looming thing. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are moving along. They're all linked. But getting ahead of things, clarity, you know, and all that, I think, are the most important themes. So
I just want to say that I think we probably will go there. I'll be very skeptical of getting into these types of investments. Not to say that they won't happen. I'm probably sure I'll be convinced otherwise. But we will be going into 2024 with, again, a large hole that we are trying to fill in a variety of ways. And we will need to be able to tell the public that we are good stewards. Not to say that those things are not. I just think that those are investments that historically have been problematic at the fund, and that to the extent that we'll be making those types of investments, I think we'll need more than a majority. I think we'll need almost close to unanimity on getting that, because we have to have a face before the public to say that we're making very prized investments that are prudent and also helpful to the to the pension. Also, these things require lots of time, as you've stated. We have almost a $2 billion fund, yet we've spent probably now 20 minutes on something that will represent, for the most part, a small portion of our asset class. So I really don't want to spend tons of time on something that is, for the most part, a small part of the asset classes that we have. So I'm a skeptic until I'm proven otherwise in terms of what we're going to do.
Fair. Well said.
I think those are good,
good
comments.
Yeah.
One thing I point out, Ryan, is, I mean, size-wise and commitment size, this would be similar to what SMU does and Rakesh is on our investment advisory committee. They've got a $2 billion endowment. They make about 20% of their commitments into this. So he would be an extraordinarily good resource as you start to go through that, both from a process standpoint and then as we get down the road on some of these things.
Yeah, some of the highest performing pensions and endowments have over allocation to private equity at any short period of time, who knows, right? But over a 5, 10, 15-year time period, you know, it's a significant asset class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what could be interesting for the actuaries to do, as long as it doesn't take time and cost, is, you know, they have projections for when we're going to catch up on the benefit, and it's largely time-dependent. But one underlying rate of return they use, and if you strip out private equity from that aggregate return, let's say they assume an 8% return with private equity, and then without private equity, maybe that's 7 or 6.5, how much further does that push out the time to catch up? And I would imagine it's a meaningful number. It'll be really hard long-term to generate the returns without it. But that said, we need to go into it, given the history, and, you know, make sure that everybody's on the same page.
Yeah, and McKee's got a tool. We can play around with it internally. We can look at zero private market, you know, 15, 20, and look at the return differences. So it is meaningful. That's why we included it in 17 and reconfirmed it. Longer term, I could see it going a little bit higher than 15, and maybe you wanted to add, you know, potentially a private debt sleeve or increase private equity to include a bit more. But, you know, right now 15 is where we're starting.
And most institutional investors would look at this giving you maybe a 200 basis point kicker to your public equities. So it would only be, you know, on 15% of the portfolio or whatever number we come up with. And then on the private debt, it's probably more like 100 basis points. But it's not going to make a big jump in the aggregate, since it is a small percent of the assets.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to
one of the reasons I'm making that comment is that we certainly should be as good stewards as we can of this asset, but that $2 billion hole isn't going to be filled by private equity. It's going to be filled by other solutions. So I think we just need to be very cognizant that that's not a solution. That's good stewardship, but we have to make sure that those other shareholders that have a stake in this pension are comfortable, not only comfortable, but confident that we're not doing something that could be viewed as maybe not worth the risk, even though there's a reward when there's a $2 billion hole.
Very good point. Very good point. I agree with that.
And I think this is, I mean, an additional benefit of doing a secondary fund is to start out, you get much broader diversification, and if any one fund blows up, it's, you know, you're not going to feel the effects of it as much.
Okay, so we're going to have, anyone else have, we're going to have Makita, they're going to talk about their potential role in this, is that what?
Yeah, I want Leo to talk a little bit about what they see other clients of our size doing, what's worked well, a little bit on their capabilities, and any questions that you guys have.
Yeah, so everyone understands, this would be contemplating Makita or someone like Makita, an expansion of a role of the consulting services to now include these asset classes on a go-forward basis. So that's the framing of it, right?
Yeah. And we just one before we go into it. If we're looking at going into possibly this asset class, and this would be something that could potentially be an additional augmented role for Makita, are we looking at, or is there even a discussion as to whether that's something we want them to do, or are we looking
at? Yes, that's all part of it.
That's part of it?
Yeah. Sometime in 2023, we're going to do an RFP and talk to more than just Makita on what it looks like, what their capabilities are, what the cost would be. So, Leo, let me know if there's a specific page in your presentation you want me to go to.
Thank you. I can hear you well. I apologize, I'm not there. I wish.
Oh, break it up a little. Leo, you're breaking up. I don't know if you can go to a different room or maybe call on a different line.
Okay, let me try something. Is it better now?
I don't know. Keep talking, I'll let you know.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's a little bit better.
Great. So, here we are. We have very, very good
activities
for clients like this.
Okay. Is there a different line you can call in from?
Yep. If you give me 1 second, I will do that.
Okay.
Can you give me 20 seconds?
Okay. Bathroom break if you need it.
It's hard to do these calls when he's kite surfing at the same time.
No, he was trying to be here, but I think got the flu and he had a sick kid in the house this week, so I doubt.
Hear me now?
Try, keep talking.
I was saying I was a price.
No.
The past few days.
Yeah, I don't know if we just.
I think we need to just, unless you can go somewhere else, we got to bail this. I can't hear.
Yeah.
Is this coming in December or the next time
you come? Yeah, I think what we do is just. We got plenty of time. Leo, you can try to call back if you want to, but we can defer this part of the discussion until next month.
He's next door.
We're talking about doing this 2020.
Yeah,
we
got
time.
6-9 months ago. So
yeah.
Let's wait till Leo's here. We can start an RFP tomorrow. We'll do it in December.
Okay. That makes sense.
All right, Leo. Thank you. Sorry. I'll call you after the meeting.
Technology. Great,
so
it's
not.
Yeah, there's always a lag on the phone, too, but on the call-in.
With him off, so, Ryan, maybe just comment real quickly on that process, your general feelings about Makita, and then as it relates to your thoughts on an RFP and so on. I mean, if we were highly dissatisfied versus generally pleased, it would affect a little bit kind of how we think and do this. So maybe just comment on that dialing.
I mean, we've been working with Makita for 5 years now, and we have a good working relationship. I feel like the messaging is always consistent between, you know, us and them, and we work well together. We haven't worked with them on the private market side, so that's really what I want to see is, like, how are we going to work together? What will that cost be? What different members of the team will we be talking to? And then I think on the RFP, you know, we haven't done one on Siegel because we wanted to have consistency. You know, we have a five-year provision, and we deferred it on a few different providers. So we should do it. I think that decision will be, like, what level do we want to go out to? Eight people do we want to go? But we had three finalists that came in 18 to present. I think RBK, Barris, and Makita. Do we want to go back out to a select group that we talked to before and see what that looks like? There's also the ability to just hire a specialty consultant that does private markets only. I don't think we're big enough or have a need for that. But overall, we're satisfied with Makita, and it's just figuring out kind of how we're working together.
So if anyone does have a differing view on that, then, you know, kind of speak up. I mean, it's not a closed session item. What we generally, they could listen if they wanted to, but we should speak up, you know, to give Ryan and team some sense of we're generally pleased, we do want to do a market check versus, you know, we think we need to fundamentally change the way we're doing everything, including that. So
are we basically just talking about the private market right now?
We'll
do the RFP on the entire consulting role.
But since the baseline part of it, a big part of it, is connected, and we have a few minutes, does anyone have any thoughts at all that they want to say to Ryan, other that's different than kind of where he is expressing to us? He's generally pleased. We're open to hearing what they have to say about expanding the role. We have to think about, is it them, is it somebody else, do we do it differently? But it's interconnected with just the core relationship. So
are we going to be able to take a look at the RFP?
What I want to do is, what we did last time is we got a subcommittee of the board, and we were able to run, like, meetings and do it a little more efficiently with three or four board members that interviewed the firms and made the selection and made the recommendation back to the board. Whatever level of check we do or RFP we do, and we have one written up that I can send to you after the meeting.
Probably could send it to the board.
Yeah.
Excellent.
We might modify it depending on the level, but I think doing a subcommittee of a few board members and a few ISU members to help us through what we do on it to be more efficient and the way to go. So I guess we'll figure out who that needs to be over the next few months, but if you have interest in helping out with that, that's I think that's where we'd go.
How are you envisioning sourcing, you know, new opportunities?
I think it's part of the discussion. I think any new investment we make, similar to on the public side, we want to have a dual recommendation. So whether it comes from the consultant only and we look at their pipeline only to start out, or we're, you know, make an internal hire at some point, or bringing ideas to the table and we're getting Makita up to speed on something that we source. Either way, we want
to. I don't think these firms will say, you know, any sort of level of approval on anything we bring. I mean, that's part of the decision is, do we start with their inventory and that's the sole captive set of things you look at, or do we do it differently? But we're not going to, they are not going to, I mean, they may look at it and say, you know, cursor, we see no red flags, but whatever the validation or support recommendation they put behind an approved manager, they're not going to do that for someone that we bring to their table unless we pay extra fees or something. Does anyone think differently than that?
No, the only thing I was going to say earlier was that in terms of the RFP and making sure that we have it broad, because I'm sure Makita has qualified people, but it's unlikely that they are as good maybe in the private as they are in the public, that there are firms that are particularly good in the private, and we just want to make sure that we tap the universe to consider all that.
And you may have two separate consultants.
I think so.
Yeah. I think you could, even though our size is, that's $100 million.
Mm-hmm.
It may be the prudent way to go.
That's my initial thing.
Yeah.
So I have a question. So in the past, I wasn't here. How were the private market deals sourced in the past? I have no idea. So I hear something, but I don't know.
So, I mean, A lot of the deals, it's different on real estate and private equity. On private equity, the issues were like not only the investments we made, but they had no energy or consistency where we invested $100 million in 2004 and then $250 million in 2006. Like, we should be doing a consistent amount per year and a consistent buy size. Like, we were doing $25 million here, $25 million here. Oh, here comes Hoff, here's $100 million. Like, there was no you know, consistency on amount you're doing and making sure you're doing a similar amount every year to base it out. So it wasn't just manager selection, it was the amount that you're putting in.
Was a consultant involved in this process?
They were
this selecting the
I don't think
fee.
There was a consistent policy or practice to making the acquisition.
There was no consistent.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, remember that draft when Ryan Leaf was chosen before Peyton Manning or Sam Bowie was picked before Jordan?
Uh-huh.
I think they used that. I think they used that process.
Okay.
Yeah.
The word private equity isn't even fair because exclude the stuff that you had to sell. It's largely energy. I mean, there was local energy.
Yeah.
Traditional private
equity. And then it sounds like you guys were sometimes the only one invested in.
Like on the Lone Star Fund, we were the only institutional. We were over half a fund.
So they probably say, we'll give you a great fee break if you come in now.
Yeah.
And we're going to work on getting other people in. You wind up being the only one coming in.
Yeah. And I mean, on the real estate side, it was a little bit different, but less involvement there. And that's why when we rewrote the IPS in 16 and 17, we added every new recommendation will have require both a staff written and a consultant written recommendation.
Okay.
So even though, you know, we might want to source some investments on our own at some point in the private markets, we want to make sure that we are putting it in front of the consultant and making them opine on it.
So the scar tissue is there, but it's like everything that you should not have done, you did.
Yeah, no, it's a bizarre.
It's self-inflicted more.
Yeah, it's almost like it's so much worse than the dartboard. I mean, it was. I think there's nothing to be garnered from it.
Yeah.
Different people. Some of these things go back to early 2000s. I mean, we're starting with a blank sheet of paper.
I mean, and some of these provisions are lessons from the past, what went wrong, and what we want to avoid.
I wouldn't.
Oh, wow.
I can only say that if you were raising a fund during that time, you could always have a meeting with Dallas Police Empire to pitch directly.
Yeah. Especially if you're local.
They made a lot of direct investments, too, in things that were not appropriate for a fund of this nature.
Okay. All right. Let's.
Hey,
we have
this is Leo. This is Leo. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. We got you now, Leo.
Yeah,
we're running late. It's going to be a better discussion when you're here in person. So let's, if there's anything quick you want to say it, but let's do the broader discussion about your role.
Yeah, let's just.
Let's do it next time.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
All right. To Mark's point, I don't want to spend 25 minutes on a potential private equity portfolio that's 15% and only 5 on the public equity portfolio that is 55%. Of the portfolio. So I'm going to go in the public equity portfolio. It is a fairly high level review. We do this once a year to reset, what we have in the portfolio. We're cover performance, we're thriving it. We can go into definitely more detail on any manager that you want to talk about, but we'll cover it at a fairly high level and open it up for any feedback or questions. So public equity, when I talk about public equity, it's really the combination of global equity and EM equity goes into the public equity composite. So right now we have $772 million in public equity at the end of October. That's 43% of DPFT. That compares to a target of 60% to public equity, 55% to global, and 5% to private equity, which is $1.1 billion. This pie chart is showing our current manager roster in public equity. We set up the structure of having 4 active global managers in July of 2017. We had Invesco and Walter Scott for a long time before that, and then we added Manulife and Boston Partners, which both have a little bit of a value tilt in their portfolio in 2017. In January of 2018, we added RBC as our sole EM equity manager. In March of 2020, we added the Northern Trust passive equity component to the portfolio. That was our first passive equity investment. And then, as I mentioned earlier, over the last year, we've been adding small cap, U.S. small cap with Eastern Shore that we funded in September 21, and then Global Alpha, our international ex-U.S. small cap manager, was funded this summer. This chart is showing where we're at in public equity now and where we've been. And one thing that one of the points, so this chart is showing market value on the equivalent line, net cash flows out of public equity on the gold bars, and then gain loss on the teal. In 16, when we had to run the bank, we depleted the public equity portfolio, and it was down to 7% of the portfolio at one point, $155 million in public equity. Since then, we've added $458 million in cash back to the public equity portfolio, $150 million coming in the last 2 years, and another $25 million going in shortly here. So we've built that portfolio back up from 7% to the 43 that we're at right now. Moving ahead, this is looking at the overall public equity performance compared to the benchmark. The benchmark is the ACWI IMI. I'm on 258 now. So long-term, the portfolio has outperformed the benchmark net of all fees. You look at the 10-year and investment. Unfortunately, over the three-year period, we are underperforming the benchmark. The reason for that, if you look at the chart on the bottom, this is showing the rolling three-year excess return. So above one is means that we're outperforming over the three-year period ending at that date. So really, we've been outperforming on the three-year for most time periods, and then we came into 2022, and really it was Q1 and Q3, our growth manager underperformed quite a bit compared to the benchmark. And then we also have the small cap and EM exposure that's performed worse than global equity at large. So the underperformance over the near term has really been driven, brought down this year, and those are the drivers of it. On this page, there's a ton of numbers here, and I'm going to use this page to talk about each manager at a high level. And as mentioned, we can go through more detail on each one, and we have a page on every manager with a bit more detail in the back. Starting at the top left, Boston Partners, they have $6.7 billion in the strategy. They're our deepest value global manager. They have a little bit bigger portfolio, more balanced, with 101 holdings in the portfolio, and we get more small mid-cap exposure with Boston Partners than our other three global managers. You can see that with the weighted average market cap being $72 million. And then just showing the value attributes of them, their price-earnings ratio in their portfolio is 11 compared to a benchmark of 15, closer to mid-20s for the growth managers. Manulife, they describe it as more where value meets quality, more large-cap exposure, looks for low-leverage companies. They have $2.7 billion total in the strategy that we're in with them. We added both these managers in 17. So Invesco is our highest growth manager. They definitely have more beta than anyone else in the portfolio. The up and down capture kind of at the bottom of the chart there shows how much of the up market they participate in and how much of the down market. So it's typical for them to outperform on the way up and underperform on the way down. And they have underperformed so far this year. Both Invesco and Walter Scott have pretty low turnover portfolios that are fairly concentrated. Invesco is especially concentrated in the top 10 names and the top 20. They have a above 10% position in Alphabet in their portfolio. And to demonstrate the long-term hold nature of their portfolio, they've had Alphabet since 2011. So they buy and hold for long-term. Walter Scott is probably our best performing manager long-term. They have a growth tilt is more growth and quality. And we've been with Walter Scott since 2004. They have $40 billion in their strategy. Moving down to the small cap managers, and when I say quality, the next few are quality bias in their portfolio. Walter Scott, Manulife has a little bit of it, Eastern Shore and RBC. And when we say quality, what they're looking for is a return on invested capital, sustainable earnings, repeatable earnings, good management, quality management, franchise value to companies, really just in a good competitive space in the environment they participate in. Eastern Shore added them in 2021, U.S. small cap, a little bit of a growth tilt, but pretty close to core, and definitely a quality focus in their portfolio. They have $500 million in the AUM, so they're a growing manager, but definitely the smallest overall of all our equity managers. Global Alpha added them early this summer. We're in a commingled fund because it's international there. It's a little bit easier to operate. They're really a true core exposure. They have no EM equity in their small cap portfolio. And 3.5 total in strategy. And then RBC, we hired them in 18. They're our only EM equity manager. They run a concentrated portfolio. They have 50 names in their portfolio. GARP focus, a growth at a reasonable price. Historically, they've been pretty underweight to China. China is a big component of the EM equity benchmark. Mike, do you know what it is?
I mean, it's changed a lot this year with China being down 40%.
Yeah. So historically, they've been very underweight to China, but given the valuation levels, they're creeping back up and getting closer to market neutral on China. So this is looking at kind of a look-through of the entire public equity portfolio. Shows our top holdings, Alphabet in the top one. You guys remember we added a 5% limit to any public equity holding into the IPF last year, so Alphabet's really the only one that gets that close to it, but we monitor that quarterly. All of our active managers have a pretty high active share, meaning that they have a different looking portfolio than the benchmark. But when you combine it, these seven managers plus the passive component, we look fairly close to the ACWI IMI on a market cap basis. And then top right there is looking at kind of where what sectors we're invested in, a little bit of overweight to materials and industrials and underweight to energy and real estate, but fairly close to the benchmark overall. This is a style map showing influences of the portfolio, large cap and small cap being on top and bottom, and then value and growth being on the left and right. The main thing to visualize here is Boston Partners and Invesco are deeper value and higher growth. Walter Scott and Manulife are closer to core. And then overall, we end up with a portfolio that maybe have a little bit of a quality growth tilt to it, but pretty close to a core portfolio overall. And then Makita's added this to their reporting quarterly. We have global managers who have a mandate to invest anywhere across the globe, and they have discretion to overweight, underweight countries to a certain standpoint. Historically, we've been, the last few years, underweight to the U.S. We've known that it's been the case that they just see better value in international compared to U.S. price levels. But I would take this with a little bit of a grain of salt because most of the companies that are investing in are global multinational companies, and classification of U.S. versus international can get a little bit murky.
Did you say, does Invesco own more than 5% of Alphabet and their portfolio?
Their portfolio, Alphabet, is like 12%. Overall, it is below 5 on everyone in our group.
Aren't our guidelines at a manager level, though, or no?
Our guidelines for their IMA are the manager level, and they're about as much as they can go. It's a 10% active limit where they can go 10% plus or minus what the benchmark has.
Something we should look at, because that's a big 12% of a portfolio, and that's why you got the volatility.
Yeah, it definitely is, and we looked at that and modified it a little bit. What we want to balance on Invesco is I don't want a portfolio that looks different than their composite, because they're managing a strategy that has that, and if we dial back their guidelines, then they're going to be managing our portfolios differently than everyone else.
There's nothing wrong with that, because we have a unique need.
Yeah.
It's something worth discussing.
Yeah, I mean, on Invesco, they have 75% concentration in their top 20 holdings, so they run a concentrated portfolio. It obviously, is volatile, and it is probably the manager of most concern in the portfolio.
That's worth a discussion given our situation.
Yeah.
We want volatile managers, that volatile of a manager.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. All right. I can go into any manager in more detail or answer any questions on the portfolio, but high-level review. Mike, anything to add on your guys?
Nope.
So when Makita talks next month, will they comment on kind of their sort of temperature on any of these managers, any of their concern, potential watch lists? That would be part of what they would discuss?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think I'll just invest in have a discussion with IAC and figure out, you know, okay, what that looks like there.
All right. Okay, great.
Hello, Ryan. This is Colin. I'm on the line. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. I can make a few comments on the global equity piece right now, if that's okay.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Awesome. So hello, everybody. I'm Colin Kowalski. I've worked with your plan for about a year with Leo and Aaron. So happy to be here, and I'm just going to make a few quick comments on the presentation that Ryan just gave. From a high level, we agree with the public equity portfolio and how it's currently constructive, and we're supportive of staff's efforts within the asset class. The portfolio, just looking at the stats that Ryan presented and talked about, the portfolio matches the index fairly closely. We're happy with stylistically the core tilt, the geographic stats and the correlations, et cetera. So from Makita's standpoint, we were happy with that, and we think it's going in the right direction. Addressing this page, actually, the excess return over the recent period doesn't look great, as Ryan mentioned. And there's a few reasons for that, one of which is Invesco. They've underperformed for the year. Also, the small cap funds have underperformed the broad market as well, and then EM as well. So those are the main drivers of that recent dip in the excess return. A few other stats that we like to look at when evaluating these performance numbers are what we call the batting average. And so if you look at the percentage of periods that we've outperformed the benchmark, over this period specifically, it's about 80% outperformed versus the passive index. And so that's really strong. And if you extend the period even longer, it's even closer to 90. Looking at it from that perspective sort of takes away some of that endpoint bias. Obviously, ending in September 2022 is a rough endpoint. So we like to evaluate it from that different angle. And from that perspective, it looks pretty solid. The other thing that is not shown here is we looked at the rolling volatility of the total portfolio versus the index, and it's lower, especially over recent periods. And so just looking at this from a standard deviation standpoint, having the portfolio be lower than the index is something strong. So those are just two points I would add on this graph that make the performance not look as menacing. On the Invesco front, we echo everything that Ryan said as well. Our research team actually met with them earlier this year, and they're okay with the strategy as is. Obviously, it's been a rough year for them with the headwinds to the growth, and their concentration in high beta have really hurt performance. So we're still comfortable with them. We're okay with the fund, and it's something that we're going to continue to monitor closely going forward. That's all the comments I had. I'll go ahead and throw it back over to you guys.
And I mean, on Invesco, it doesn't make up for the underperformance, but we've also negotiated a fee break on their portfolio.
You talked about batting average. What's Invesco's batting average in terms of performance?
Well, you might have a handy call on.
Yeah, I don't have it completely in front of me, but it's pretty good. It's only been out of the periods they have, which is about 36 periods, they've only underperformed the past 8. So the batting average is probably around 70%.
And that's probably compared to a core benchmark. Invesco is to the point where, like in the Makita report, we compare them to a core and a growth. They're a growth peer group. Growth is probably a more appropriate benchmark to look at them, especially in a period like this.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just looking at versus the core benchmark.
We have the batting average about 60%.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds right. I didn't have it completely in front of me. I was just looking at the raw numbers of an estimate, but 60% sounds right.
Okay. And one thing I talked to Makita about is we show the public equity portfolio as a whole passive, but it may be beneficial to carve out the active part of it just to see where we're really taking the active bet, because the passive is really just diluting everything back to benchmark when you include that. So we got a few managers to keep an eye on. We'll keep reporting back to you guys with annual updates on the public equity.
Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to put number 13, which is our legal issues, which we're going to do in this other setting. So we're going to move up and do the hardship request and the executive director's report. So, Kelly, those are both for you.
John, will you go to slide 287 and leave it there and not go to the other pages that I talk about? Okay, so prior to 2017, when the legislation was passed, members and retirees that had drop accounts, well, actually, retirees that had drop accounts could request their drop balance at any time. They'd ask for it by Tuesday, and they would get it by Friday. With the legislation change, that ability was eliminated. And what happened to their drop balance was it was converted into an annuity, a stream of payments that they received over their expected lifetime. In that process, the legislation also created a hardship requirement. So now they can't get their money on demand, but they can request a hardship. It's very limited, however, when they can request this hardship. So the statute itself says they can have a lump sum distribution from a drop account in the event of a hardship that's not reasonably foreseeable. And then the board can adopt rules. So the board that first came on in 2017 put together the rules related to this, and they went through and identified certain circumstances that would qualify for a hardship and also other rules related to hardship. If we have a hardship request. I can approve a hardship if I feel like it meets the board's requirements, but I cannot deny one. So if I am either borderline on approval or not, or am recommending denial, I bring it to the board. There are sometimes we can talk about this in closed sessions, and sometimes we can't. If it's related to a medical issue, I talk to you in more detail in closed sessions. This one is not medical related, so I can't go into closed sessions. So I'm going to be very cryptic for confidentiality. In your agenda materials, which we're not going to put up on the board, we have summarized this person's financial information, and that is because the requirements are that the severe financial hardship, I'm sorry, the pages for the, there's three pages, they start at 351 in your materials. So there needs to be a severe financial hardship that exists at the time the application was made. I believe they meet that requirement. The hardship cannot be relieved through other means, and the policy says includes in parens, i.e., compensation from insurance or other sources, monthly annuity benefits, or liquidation of personal assets, unless using those sources would cause a financial hardship. So what that basically means is you can't give a hardship if they have other sources that would take care of the issue. The board went through the circumstances that would qualify, and in this particular instance, it's clear that the circumstance complies with it. So I'm not recommending denial based on the circumstance. So if you look at the top of page 351, I identify you what the circumstance was, and you'll recall.
Is this a home or a property?
This is a personal residence, and it was that big rain that we had, big rain.
Primary residence?
Yes.
Okay.
It's still livable, though, the person still living in. You can see the cost is the first number there of the repairs, and then when they take a hardship distribution, we have to withhold taxes, so this is gross up for the taxes. So the request that they have is that bottom number. The next page is a balance sheet, and the way we come up with this is they provide information to us, and some things we have to estimate. Some things we have to use on Zillow, and you can see there's a primary residence here, a rental property, some checking accounts and those types of things. We also have liabilities. So here you have the ratio of assets to liabilities quite significant. One of the liabilities that you see here, the third one from the bottom, is actually the financing that the company provided the member to take care of the repairs. So there's no outstanding bill, but there's this financing. It probably has a high rate of interest, would be my guess, but we don't have documentation on that. The next slide is really a cash flow. I'm not going to call it an income statement because it doesn't have kind of food and clothing and other incidentals, but it does say here's your total monthly income for this person and their spouse, less taxes and medical insurance, and then here's the monthly expenses, and what this person provided was just those things that are paid on bills, not food and gasoline and those types of things. So there's basically the income after the bills is about, I think, 60% of their income is still available after they pay their bills, 57%. So my opinion in looking at this, I believe that they can take care of this without a hardship distribution, but it's the board's decision.
I think it's important to remember we adopted this based on the legislature to have hardship withdrawal to make sure that this wasn't an end run around getting money out of the drop account so we could preserve the capital for the ongoing benefits and investments. So I think that's really the key in why we did this. And we've had some crazy requests. So we've been very strict on trying to stay the whole line on the reserve funds in the pension fund.
Kelly, what's your recommendation?
My recommendation is denial. And this is really difficult. This is one of the most difficult things that we have to do because kind of keep in mind that the reason they had drop accounts was basically their savings account for events like this. But the board adopted strict rules because of the needs of the plan. It's hard.
And some of those rules, just to recap for some of our newer members, some of those rules that were put in place, you can't take a hardship pay for college.
Right.
There's certain things you can and cannot. Secondary education is not one of them.
Right, because the board determined that was reasonably foreseeable that you would have that. And even medical expenses. You can take one for you can do medical expenses. That's right. And funeral expenses.
And we're sure this is on the primary, not the rental property.
Yes. But as you can see, the rental property, and I actually looked it up, it's booked all the time. It says short-term rental. There is no mortgage on the second property, so it seemed like there was some ability there.
Does anyone have a view contrary to Kelly's recommendation? Okay, so can we have a motion to deny the hardship request?
I would move that.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Kelly, your executive director's report.
Okay. Beginning on 291 is your innkeeper's monitor. Open records requests, we've had none since the last board meeting, which has been nice. I want to talk to you just really briefly about the disability process. Our statute requires that we have an independent doctor look at any disability application request, and since 2016 we've used this company MRO, and they were great for about 3 years, but beginning in 2019 their service really fell off, and then it really was poor after the COVID. They're just not workable anymore. I did reach out to some other plans, and I have a doctor here just off of Preston Road, Dr. Toms, who's with OCMED, OCCMD. She basically does this for a living, reviews documents, and has 21 nurses working for her that they can review our disability application. So I'm recommending changing that process. The board doesn't need to take any action. I just want to alert you that we're going to switch it and see how this goes. I will be bringing back to you two disability applications for next month. Something that you can look forward to.
Quick question on the changing of the provider. Any costs associated with savings or?
I think there might be cost savings because the MRO charged us a flat a beginning flat fee of $3,650 just for an application. And then if there were specialists or extra time, they would charge additional fees, and the doctor's charging an hourly rate.
Okay.
So I believe there might be some cost savings, but we'll see how long it takes. And they do have the ability to refer out to specialists if need be.
Just trigger one thought. Do we do you list, or would it make sense to send once a year to all of us a list of all the vendors we use?
Sure.
I think that'd be helpful. You know, you mentioned like a company. We all the time looking at these types of businesses that, you know, and you might have seen it or know people or whatever. I just think that would be helpful that we all know who are all the vendors we're doing business with for whatever reason. Okay. All right, so now I think we'll go into closed session.